Tonight on The Download, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Lyle Lovett. We reload this week's news with Chicago Tribune's Ray Long and DNA Info's Heather Sharone. And live music from Judith Owen. Now, here's your host, a man who stayed up way too late watching C-SPAN 2 last night, Justin Kaufman.
I guess it's on me because I've always known C-SPAN. But C-SPAN 2? Oh, so good. Also, there's a C-SPAN 3, but you know what? It's not my take. Yeah, when I got home last night, that was, you know, I wanted to watch the historic Senate debate and vote, and I was looking for it, and I was trying to figure out. I got the C-SPAN, and they just had on some sort of, I don't even know what you would call it. It was like some sort of hearing that was taped, right? It was something about, I don't know, forest fires or something like that. And then I'm like, what's a C-SPAN 2? And I go to C-SPAN 2, and it is just unanchored. One camera shot of the Senate chambers. I've never watched TV like that before in my life. I was like, this is so refreshing. And at the same time, I knew I was missing out. Like, I didn't know who was voting for what. They were just saying names and things like that. I'm like, if I were watching CNN, you know, they would
mm-hmm.
you know,
talking over it.
Don Lemon would be like,
that's a very important thing.
Yeah, but I just sat there for like 10 minutes, just felt like a voyeur, like I was watching something I shouldn't.
That's why I prefer for the White House Correspondents' Dinner to watch C-SPAN 2, because the same thing, you know, all like the Fox News and the CNNs, they have anchors talking over it. See, they just have the camera right there, and you're like,
I love it.
Oh, who's Arianna Huffington coming in with?
I just love it. There's something about it. I think from here on out, that might be the way that I calm down when I get home from the shift. Just put on C-SPAN 2. I don't know what will be on, but it's just sort of like, there's no anchor. There's nothing.
They don't have that
unfettered access.
They don't have that guy doing the talk show where people call up and swear at him.
I think that might be C-SPAN 1.
Oh, that's the original.
Yeah, C-SPAN 2 is just unfettered.
The camera.
Yeah, I give him that. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you tonight till 11 o'clock tonight. We've got a jam-packed show. Unbelievable show tonight. Lyle Lovett is going to join us right after the break coming up here. Lyle Lovett, the Grammy Award winner, is going to be at the Chicago Theater this Saturday. Tomorrow, Lyle Lovett. How awesome. He's coming in with his large band. Talk to him about his career, his music. Lots to talk to Lyle Lovett about. He's coming up. Also tonight, we reload this week's news. Ray Long, the Chicago Tribune, Heather Sharone from DNA Info. Ton to talk about. Rance Priebus out. Wow. We'll talk about the soda tax. Is the soda tax back? And Ray Long's been doing some amazing work for the Tribune on the water department emails. And they've been able to trace to the point where they even got breaking news that just came out 15 minutes ago about a state official where some of the racist, sexist, homophobic emails began. He traced a forward back to where it began. And looks like that person is going to retire as a state official. So we'll talk with Ray Long. We'll also get the biggest stories, overreported, underreported. What story is going to remember in 10, 15, 50, 500 years from tonight? My guess, robots in their new language. That's the one I'm going to go with, right? Did you hear about the story that Facebook AI? That's crazy. It's not like Pig Latin. They're on their own. Got to figure it out. So we'll talk all about that. And then coming up later, Judith Owen, great British Welsh-born singer-songwriter, will be in studio with one of the legends of music, Leland Sklar. Leland Sklar is one of the best bass players in the history of music. He has recorded on over 2,000 albums. And we're not talking about like every... It's not like it's this guy who hangs out at the Hideout. We're talking James Taylor, who's in James Taylor's band. Phil Collins, you know, all the Phil Collins stuff he was on. I could go on. The list would be every single artist that's ever recorded at any time on a major label. Leland Sklar has played on it. He will be in studio tonight in the 9 o'clock hour with Judith. They will be playing live music here on The Download. How great is that? We'll talk about mystery novels tonight. Lori Raider Day and Kristen Lepianka will be in studio. Kristen, both of these books are very, they're both getting great reviews. And they are in town for a joint sort of reading signing tomorrow in Forest Park. So thought, hey, come on in together. Kristen's book is The Last Place You Look. Lori's book is The Day I Died. Both brand new novels that are out this summer in the thriller, crime fiction, mystery category. So we'll talk about that genre coming up as well. So a lot to do tonight. What a great, great show. So what we'll do is we'll take a break here, and we'll come back, and we'll get Lyle Lovett all queued up. Let's news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leanne, Roger Badish tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a Grammy Award winner and a music legend. To say that Lyle Lovett is a country musician is selling him short. The musician and bandleader has excelled in defying categories, playing soulful country, blues, jazz, gospel, you name it. Then you add actor to the resume as well, longtime regular in Robert Altman films. Lovett has produced so many albums in his career and so much great music, evidenced by his greatest hits collection that he put out earlier this year. He and his large band will be performing Saturday night at Chicago Theater right here in town. Tickets still available for that show. Lyle Lovett joins me now on The Download. Mr. Lovett, it's a pleasure to have you here on 720. We appreciate it.
Yes, and thanks. Well, thanks for the brilliant intro, and I really appreciate you helping us get the word out about our show.
You've come through Chicago many a times. Talk about Chicago and you know, coming here and playing this town. What does Chicago mean to Lyle Lovett?
You know, Chicago's always been so great to me. The audience there is always, you know, I mean, people keep showing up at our shows, and it's just a wonderful feeling. I mean, you know, Chicago's just one of the greatest big cities in the world, in my opinion, and I just always, we get to play Chicago, gosh, nearly every year, and so I just always look forward to coming back.
You know, you've had a lot of support here from radio stations, other places too, but it's interesting because this town is not one you automatically think about, you know, when you think about Texas folk music, but it does have a long-standing tradition with folk music and jazz and blues, of course.
Well, it does. It does. I mean, it's that whole connection, I think, from the South, when the Delta blues players moved up north to Chicago. I mean, I think there is a real appreciation in Chicago for roots-based music, and that's certainly what my music is. And so, the audience just couldn't be nicer. And people are, you know, good people are good people, you know, they certainly treat us, the band and me, so well when we come to Chicago. I mean, it's a big city, but it still has small-town sensibilities, you know, so that's something that I certainly relate to when I come to Chicago. And I'm guessing that's part of what the audience sees in the band and me as well.
As you mentioned, roots music, and I said you kind of defy categories. It is interesting because roots music has taken off in the way that there's now several subgenres to roots, whether it be Americana or alt country and all these other kinds of sounds. But where do you you defy categories. When I think of your music, and I've played the heck out of a lot of your records, I almost feel like it's Southern gospel. You know, that it's not necessarily a country music or a folk music, that it has its roots in the church. When you talk about the music, I mean, you say it's roots-based music?
I say that, but it's, yeah, and it really is. I just write songs in styles of music that I like, really. And I try to suit the style of music. You know, I try to support the lyrical idea with a musical style that is appropriate for it. And, you know, growing up in Texas, going to clubs in Texas, people were trying to just play good songs. They weren't terribly concerned about, you know, concerned about what sort of category a song would fit into. But when I would go to places like Anderson Fair in Houston and hear Eric Taylor and Nancy Griffith and John D'Amato and Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt and Vince Bell, they were trying to play a good song. They were trying to write a good song, the style was of less importance. You know, playing music and playing in different styles is fun as well. But really, I just try to think of a musical form that will support, you know, the words that I'm trying to convey.
Yeah, I Googled and came across an article that was written about you in 1986 when you put out your first album, and this was really about how you had come to Nashville 2 years before to be a songwriter. talk about that. Talk about the idea of really you are a songwriter at heart. How did that experience of being a songwriter first help you in being able to transition into the musician that you are today?
Well, I always loved playing, and I just always felt like I wasn't a good enough singer or a good enough musician to be able to do other people's songs and have people be interested in me. I thought if I had something to offer people, if there was a reason for people to come see me, it needed to be my point of view more than anything else. And so that's why I started making up my own songs. I didn't think it was a realistic ambition to ask for a record deal when I went to Nashville. I got to a point in my life, I was 25, 26 years old, and I thought to myself, I need to learn about the business. I need to figure out how this works, or I need to get a real job of some sort. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go to Nashville and see, because that was a place where Nashville was a place receptive to songs and songwriters. And, the great publishing houses were still thriving in Nashville. And so I went with the idea of, well, maybe I can get somebody interested in doing my songs. And that was my approach. I was not disappointed, but sort of surprised and maybe a little disappointed when I play my demo tape for a publisher and they say, yeah, the song's okay, but who's singing? Or who's the band and who's singing? And so it was really beyond my wildest dreams that I ended up getting a record deal as well as a publishing deal. And so being able to be a singer-songwriter with a Nashville-based record label was sort of outside the box. Nashville is a factory town in a way. There are publishing companies with staff writers who write songs that the big country stars record. So being a singer-songwriter based in Nashville was something unique to that sort of mid-80s period when singer-songwriters like Steve Earle and Nancy Griffith and Dwight Yoakam and Katie Lang were making their first records as well.
Yeah. Lyle Lovett, my guest, he's going to be at the Chicago Theater tomorrow night here in Chicago. One of the things, you tour with a large band, so you are, it's Lyle Lovett and the large band, you are the band leader. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of being a singer-songwriter, and we've covered that territory, but being on stage with a band like this and like you said, trying to find the right sound for the lyrics that you've written. Talk about the art of being a good band leader.
Oh, gosh. The key to being a good band leader is being the worst musician in the band. I work with such talented players that they can just do anything that I think of. And our large band has really turned into a family at this point. I've worked with the musicians in the band for so long. Matt Rawlings, who plays piano, and Ray Herndon, who plays guitar, I met in 1983 when they were both in the house band at a great country nightclub in Phoenix called Mr. Lucky's. James Gilmer's and I have played together since 1978. John Hagen's played with us since 1979. Harvey Thompson of the Muscle Shoals Horns has been in every horn section I've ever played with starting in 1988. Getting together once or twice a year with these musicians in the large band is such a thrill for me. And to just be able to stand in the middle of them and listen to them is, it's an extraordinary experience for me every night. The thing that I try to do as a band leader, my main objective is to let to have the audience have the feeling of having gotten to know everybody in the band by the end of the show. I just try to put a show together that showcases everybody in the band and gives the audience a chance to get to know them all as characters, because they are characters. Let me tell you, Matt Rawlings introduced me to Francine Reed in 1984, and I've toured with Francine as often as I could ever since then. And she's out with us again this summer.
That's great.
And she's certainly a highlight of the show, and people love to hear Francine. And Francine was born in Cook County Hospital.
Oh, there you go.
She was originally from Chicago.
We like
before
to hear
she
that.
And her family moved down to Phoenix. Yeah.
The last question I'll ask is just about how important your instruments are, because, you have been known with your acoustic guitars, and Bill Collins just passed from Austin, Texas, where you played a lot of his guitars. We've talked about songwriting, we talked about being a band leader, but Mr. Collins made great guitars, and you were a big proponent of his work, and you used his stuff. How important is the instrument that you use on stage?
Oh, gosh, different guitars, I believe that different guitars have different songs in them. Different guitars sort of hit you in a way that inspires thought. And you can pick up a new guitar or pick up a guitar you hadn't played in a while, and it takes you in a direction. Bill Collins was, I've known Bill Collins since 1978. I met him on the recommendation of a singer-songwriter in Houston named Rick Gordon, who played an early Collins guitar. And I was looking for somebody to do a fret job on my Martin D35. And I called Bill Collins and I said, hey, I've got this Martin. Would you take a look at it? He said, sure, come on over. And he lived in a little two-bedroom apartment in Houston. And he lived in one bedroom, and the other bedroom was his shop, full of saws and wood and files and chisels and guitar parts. And I remember showing up at his house at 2 in the afternoon, and I left about 10 that night. He showed me every piece of wood he had. He showed me what he was working on.
Wow.
He was so enthusiastic about what he was doing and so committed to it. And he was fascinating to spend time with. We got to be friends then. He did that fret job on my D35. And a couple of visits later, I ordered my first Collins Dreadnought, which he finished for me in 1979, and it was the 29th guitar he ever built. And that's a guitar that I played on all my early recordings and used to tour with, and I still have and value. Bill and I, gosh, we did lots of fun things together outside of music as well. He and I were off-road motorcycle riding buddies. We'd go down to Baja and Mexico together and ride, and I've been on the road this since he's passed, and it still doesn't seem real that he's gone. There's going to be a memorial service for him Monday in Austin, and that falls right on a day off for us, so I'm going to be able to go down for that. But just a wonderful person and an amazing craftsman, and his guitars, I tell you, his guitars will speak for him for years to come.
Wow, that's great. Lyle Lovett, the tremendous music legend, also the multiple Grammy Award winner. He's going to be at the Chicago Theater tomorrow night right here in Chicago, downtown Chicago. Lyle, thanks so much for taking some time out and talking to us tonight on The Download. I really appreciate it.
Justin, thanks for having me on. And that Chicago Theater is just one of the greatest theaters in the world. I mean, it's for that big of a house, 4,000 seats or so. It really is an amazing sounding theater. I'm always excited to be there on that stage.
And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony.
Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. You know what they say about former White House chiefs of staff, don't you?
What do they say?
A former White House chief of staff gathers no moss. It's good to see Reince Priebus out and about tonight on with Wolf Blitzer already.
He's exclusive.
Yeah. Yeah, I like how earlier Pat Brady was on with Rokon and said, I don't expect him to be out and about for a while.
He's going to keep a low profile.
Yeah, about 45 minutes.
And you know it, but it's like we're here we are.
Yeah.
When the word exclusive is going to get thrown around for at least 3 weeks.
That's right.
It's going to be the Fox News channel later. It's going to say they have an exclusive, and then someone else, and then they're going to get to C-SPAN 2 and be like, exclusive.
Well, what Wolf should have done and CNN should have done, instead of use the word exclusive, said, we got him before Hannity.
Yeah, there you
That's
go.
That's what he should have said.
Before Hannity.
Right.
That's all.
That's right.
With a very special before Hannity interview. All right. Thank you, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you tonight. It's 11 o'clock. It's time to reload this week's news. Biggest stories. Overreported, underreported, winners, losers. What story sucks you down the rabbit hole? Which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week? There's a lot to choose from. In studio tonight to help us, the panel, Ray Long, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Good to see you, Ray.
Hello there, Justin.
And Heather Sharon. Heather, of course, the City Hall reporter for DNA Info. Heather, good to see you.
Always happy to be here.
And, of course, you, 312-981-7200. If you have some ideas for what the biggest stories are, the winners, losers, kind of comment on what's overreported, underreported, 312-981-7200. All right, well, why don't we get to the biggest story of the week? I mean, at first I was like, there's no brainer, but I mean, geez, just even today, whether it be the ousting of Priebus or the soda tax law. Okay, so let's get in. But we all still agree the biggest story was what happened in the Senate last night.
100%.
Yes, yes. Just craziness, pure craziness to go to this point where we're battling now and then we do this skinny repeal and then we're all frozen wondering what will happen, and then John McCain comes riding up on his white horse. He might as well have been on a horse in the Senate chambers, and boom, he says no, and then we're stalled again.
You know, I was thinking about this, and a lot of my job is tracking laws and, you know, watching as they go through the process and making sure that I understand sort of where they are and they mean. And it's not the easiest thing in the city of Chicago. I used to cover government in California, and they have much stronger open meeting laws and open document laws. But here, at least in Chicago, there's a 48-hour notice, or if it's an emergency situation, it's a 24-hour notice. Last night, I was glued to C-SPAN, being the good political junkie that I am. And, you know, it is, you know, boggles my mind that skinny repeal, I'm using air quotes, I'm on the radio, you can't see that, it was introduced at 10 o'clock, and then they voted on it at midnight. So that's when the vote was scheduled. It was delayed because McCain threw a wrench in the works. But in between that time, the Republican senator from Wyoming, Enzi, he spent an hour filibustering and refusing to answer questions about what this legislation is. And, you know, it was such high political drama. I mean, I saw a tweet from TV columnist James Poniewozik of the New York Times, and he was tweeting with Alan Sepinwall, who writes about TV for Up Rocks, and they said they were sort of imagining this as written by Aaron Sorkin. Yeah. And Alan Sepinwall's response was, no, it's a little macho.
Ray, I mean, the real takeaway on this, and you kind of, if you paid attention to the political, I guess, the waves this week, Senator McCain went at it with a speech earlier in the week where he said, enough of this stuff. Let's get back to, I forgot what he called it. It's been such a week, but he's just like, let's get back to the idea of normalcy here in the Senate. This is not how we do things, tricks and smokescreens and hiding things and introducing bills at the last minute. Yet it seemed like Mitch McConnell did it again, and he got burned.
Well, you know, And that happens in state legislatures, certainly with ours, you know, where there can suddenly be something that pops up. But the idea that McCain had that kind of comeback speech after having this heavy-duty cancer operation only a few days before, and he calls basically for the Senate to come back to the higher moral ground on this whole craziness that's happening in
essentially changing the rules.
Yeah, that's right. And so then he comes out and he is that swing vote. And basically, by voting no and joining two other Republicans voting no, they denied the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, a chance to get anything through on Obamacare repeal right now. And really, what that does is that McCain has thrown this into the potential of getting some kind of bipartisan effort.
You heard Chuck Schumer afterwards saying, let's go back into committees. Let's try to work together. Yeah. John McCain, of course, let's take the high ground. Let's get back together. Mitch McConnell saying, I'd love to hear your side. What do you guys want to do? Talking to the Democrats. Do you think that that might be a cue that we might see some bipartisan work coming out? I mean, Schumer did say that Obamacare is flawed and we have to fix it. The Republicans have said the same thing. Is there any way that they say, you know what, we're all going to work together on this, or is it really still about who wins and who loses?
Go ahead. I mean, you know, I mean, I think it really is about.
Gosh, I sure wish I had a crystal ball. But if I could go back for a minute, we've spent, I don't know, 10 minutes or so talking about John McCain. I feel duty bound to note that his vote only mattered because of Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who were no's pretty much from the beginning. Yeah. And McCain is only the swing vote because they said no. And I think it bears talking a little bit, if we're talking about rules and norms and talking about what happened to Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who was literally called by the Interior Secretary and you know, by all accounts, according to the Alaska newspaper, was told, gee, you've got a really nice state there. It would be a shame if something happened to it because you're not going to vote for, you know, Obamacare repeal. Right. And, you know, she is one of, you know, only a handful of women in the Senate, an even smaller fraction of Republican women. And, you know, she refused to hold scheduled hearings on the Interior Department. So, you know, John McCain, you know, is a war hero and will be, this will be, if not in the first line of his obituary, yeah, it will be in the second paragraph of his obituary. It's hard to top, you know, I survived 5 years as a prisoner of war, yeah, in Vietnam and then ran for president and served for decades in the Senate. But, you know, his vote matters because two women stood up and stood
and
up very publicly.
Yeah, took a lot of crap. I mean, there was these weird statements from other senators who were like, oh,
yes,
if they were men, I'd have a duel.
Yes.
And there's like physical, it was just, what is happening? And you're absolutely right. And today there was a great tweet that I read where someone said, welcome to every day at every job for a woman, where McCain, that's happening in boardrooms everywhere where a guy gets all the credit and the women did the work. So.
Every female reporter I have ever worked with has had the experience of sitting in a pitch meeting and pitching a story and having no response. And then the man sitting next to her repeating it almost word for word and being greeted with rapturous, you know, adulation and hosannas as they throw, you know, resources at him as he walks out of the door.
Well, we definitely are going to pay attention to the story, not only just tonight, but as we move on. 312-981-7200. Let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll start down the winners and losers categories. A big week for I had a hard time with winners. A big week for losers. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman here, Ray Long, Heather Sharon in studio. We're doing winners and losers now as we reload this week's news. Why don't we go to winners? Heather, you got a winner who I think was in the loser category last week,
yes,
but she has turned it around.
Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle is going to sleep much easier tonight. Today a judge announced that the much maligned soda tax, pop tax, is going to go into effect in Wednesday. So,
she says sweetened beverage
tax.
Yes.
Well, because it's a very complicated ordinance.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was facing the prospect of a $200 million deficit next year, not to mention a, you know, $68 million deficit for the rest of this fiscal year. And that now seems like maybe she won't have to fill.
Okay, I'll ask about the two things that automatically come to mind. What happens to those layoffs that our people have already gotten their pink slips on? And what, I mean, is it the end or are we in the game? We know better as politically minded consumers of the news. It's going to be appeal, 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 appeal all the way to wherever.
Right. I would be shocked if the Illinois Retail Merchants Association didn't appeal the judge's decision today. So it's certainly not done. And that's why Tony Preckwinkle hasn't rescinded any of those layoffs, because I think the possibility of another judge coming in and reversing him and reimposing the ban is a real possibility. And I think that, quite rightly, President Preckwinkle doesn't want to get into a situation where she's laying people off, not laying people off, and then laying them off again. But I can tell you from talking to county officials yesterday and this morning, no one thought that this judge was going to allow the soda tax to move forward. So it is manna from heaven for her.
I mean, and I guess it's such a strange story, too, because even she's had trouble advocating for it in the way that the narrative has changed from at one point we need it to plug the revenue hole. Oh, but this is also about the health of our citizens in Cook County. There were a lot of mixed messages around this. And a very concerted effort and lobby effort from the Retail Merchants Association and others to say, hey, listen, this is too much tax. You're doubling what it costs to get a 2-liter pop. This is not what we want in Cook County. And a concerted effort to stop that.
Oh, yeah. And I think that they felt that they had a good argument, too, and they won the TRO. And so the problem there is that a TRO is just that. Let's stop things, let's get a grip on things, and let's study it through. And I think you're right, Heather, that a lot of the politicians thought, this judge, no way he's going to let that go. But he actually ruled on what seemed to be a sensible law. Why couldn't you tax these beverages away? And it's not just sweetened or sugar sweetened, it's artificially sweetened drinks too. So we're all going to feel.
Now, Heather, I'll ask you this. You covered, and I got into it a little bit with the Cook County Board President when she was on the show last week. I said, it's kind of like, what do you do when you think about the bag tax? The idea that if the goal is to make something better, and you have projected how much revenue is going to come in. If you succeed in making it better, that revenue is going to come down. She says it's more like the cigarette tax. That's what she was saying. That's not like the bag tax, more like cigarette tax. But either way, the idea that the government is depending on a huge chunk of revenue and at the same time saying we need to stop our citizens from drinking this. So I you see what I mean? Like the idea that if it is about budget hold, and I'm afraid that if it's she's successful in trying to deal with obesity, there's still going to be a budget hold.
Well, her argument would be, and you know, this is of course to be seen, is that if you're Cook County residents who are reliant on the public hospital system, drink sweetened beverages, fewer of them will develop diabetes and other health-related issues that are putting a very significant burden on the county health system. So her argument is that it will benefit both the front end in terms of money coming in, but it will also benefit the back end, and there will be less money going into the health system, and there will be fewer people suffering from really, you know, horrific diseases. You know, people lose limbs, people lose eyesight from diabetes. It's a very serious issue. But I think your argument is, what is the aim of this tax is a really good one. Do we need this because we can't pay our bills and, you know, it's a zero sum game. You either, you know, cut spending or you raise revenue or you borrow money. Okay. Well, it's not a zero sum game, but it's three options.
Sure.
Or are we doing this because we want to be as a society healthier and we're making this decision collectively? I don't know.
I guess they can coexist, but it seems like it's a hard sell.
Well, Richard Boykin, the Cook County Commissioner, who's been a big critic of the tax, said today after court that he believed Tony Preckwinkle's very public layoffs bullied the judge into reconsidering his take on the tax. And I don't know that we have any evidence of that because he had a 15-page ruling that was very sort of drawn out about the legal basis for his decision. But, I wrote tons of stories about these layoffs. The Tribune wrote a lot of stories about, you know, judges don't live in vacuums.
And seemed to be part of seemed a little bit to be, you know, I'm not saying that that's what the president did, but it does seem to be effective in the way that if the court takes their time, there will be consequences. That's essentially what she said.
Absolutely.
All right, Ray, you got a story, a winners this week, which is it's more literal in the way that it's sport. But
absolutely. Yeah, mine is the Cubs. I mean, they have just come blowing out of the gates here since the All-Star break. And what we have only seen a couple of games that they've lost. They've taken over first place. They're going into Milwaukee. They're playing right now. And in fact, we're going to feel that whole fever again.
There was a concern before the All-Star break that we weren't, that this would be sort of what we know of Cubdom, where they win 1 year and they lose the next. But they, in a week and a half's time, have turned us back into a pennant fever city.
Yeah, we got a new pitcher from the White Sox, and Schwarbaum 2 last night. We were rocking again. Rizzo's got 24 home runs.
And Chris Bryant didn't break his finger off in that ridiculous sliding play.
Quintana is throwing great, so we're seeing some action there.
I had on my story, which was about the Cubs, but it was I'll just mention it and we'll move on, but the Cubs and the mayor are getting such an interesting fight. They continually have conflict. And this time it's about 54. The Cubs want the full max night game load that the Major League Baseball will let, and it's 54 games. The city's like, nah.
Well, what's interesting is that the way the ordinance and the Cubs works is they say you can have a total number of 46. Do with what you want with 46. You can do night games or you can do concerts. The Cubs keep all of the money from the concerts.
So they
scheduled as many concerts as they could, and that was essentially the mayor's point. You want more night games? Sure. That's the limit. You can either have concerts or you can have games that you have to split with Major League Baseball. What's interesting was how angry the mayor was.
He didn't see. He's talking about closed door meetings, and he was sitting right in my office. And
I mean, there's really not a lot of love lost between the mayor and Crane Kenny, the president of baseball operations.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, of course, you know, the mayor is a huge Cubs fan. He was in Cleveland when they won the series. But I think there's a sense that from City Hall that the Cubs are trying to push that envelope as far as they can.
Heather Sharon, Ray Long in studio. We will take a break at an update on tonight's news, and we will come back. We'll do the losers. This is the big category. There's a lot of losers this week. We're reloading this week's news. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Ray Long, Heather Terone in studio tonight as we reload this week's news, 312-981-7200. All right, so I guess we go to the one everyone's waiting for, the losers category. A lot of this, you know, this segment. We do biggest story, winners, losers, underreported, overreported. Which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 5,500 years from this week? But let's, the loser category, a lot going on. But let's start tonight with some breaking news. I mean, Ray, you guys have been on fire at the Chicago Tribune, really going after something that at first just felt like a holdover, you know, not even, innocent's not the right word, but just like people forwarding dumb racist emails.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You get that. I mean, that this has started with the water department, but you've been on this team that's exposed something that's much bigger.
Yeah. What we've done in the latest is that Frank Capuzzi, a state worker who had been there in the state about 40 years, turns out to be one of the guys, the main guy who was forwarding many of these racist, really over-the-top emails, the ones that were
sexist, homophobic, I mean, yes, all the way down the line. Right?
And so he was the one sending these into the water department, and then they were spreading around from there. But so we wrote about that on Monday, and then tonight, right before we came here in the studio, we filed a story that said that he has retired now from the state. He's going to have his last day on Monday. So he's the latest casualty in a casualty string that has included five people from the water department and a private construction group, too.
There are a lot of levels in this story. I mean, the first is, all right, who still forwards emails?
Right.
Number one. That's number one of those of that kind. But two, the idea that this was, it's a sting that we've seen, especially in city departments or state departments,
right.
This boys club kind of idea,
yeah.
Where there's a crew of that will continue to do things that as taxpayers you don't want to be in the ether at being discussed at all.
Yeah, it's kind of like towel snappers in the locker room who have just gotten out of control. They think everything they say is funny, even if it's gross and indecent and homophobic and everything that you don't want your children to grow up to be. They have not got the corner of it, but they have thrown so many of these emails around, and the people in charge of the water department didn't do anything to stop them.
I mean, that's the scandal. You know, there are people who make bad decisions, but the fact that there was the commissioner of the water department who was on these email chains and did nothing but, you know, sort of, you know, move along down his inbox, I think that's what the real issue is. You know, the other thing is, and the reason why I think that it's been so damaging for Mayor Emanuel is that because, like you said, it seems like a holdover from the Daily years. It
right.
seems like
right.
from the 80s, the bad old days of council wars and, you know, open racism, which we as a society have decided that is not acceptable anymore. And the fact that it was so pervasive and there were so many people on these emails,
right.
And it comes from the water department, which, you know, has just a tortured history of just being, for lack of a better term, a cesspool,
right.
you know, of
right.
of patronage hires.
Yeah.
And to
yeah.
top it all off, of course, you've got a son of a former alderman who is the one spreading all this filth throughout the department. This is Paul Hansen.
It's a very salacious story and one that the Tribune investigative team's been all over. So we'll find out more about that story as it continues to unfold. All right, moving on. The other area I think that we have to talk about is state government. I mean, this is part of it because it was a state official, but another story here, as we have found a way to continue the dysfunction from the budget, which we finally found a way to come to an agreement on, and just sort of transferred it to school funding, and we are seeing, once again, a conflict and chaos running amok in Springfield over school funding, vetoes, veto majorities, and whether or not the schools in our state are going to open on time.
only in Illinois can you reach an agreement that includes a trap door, which means that the most important function, I think many people would argue, won't get done, which is, of course, opening the schools on time.
Yeah.
And it's a really strange situation in that the governor is demanding that Democrats send him a bill that he is not happy with, except that he's happy with 90% of it, he said. And the part that he's not happy with resolves a very serious funding crisis that threatened last spring to close Chicago public schools 3 weeks early. And it's just, it's a, and I don't know how it plays out.
Yeah, nobody really does. I think nobody really wants the schools not to open, right? But
especially not schools in downstate and the suburbs.
Right, right. And but also Chicago, too.
Right. But I think that for Rahner's political purposes,
right,
not opening schools in Chicago, because he could argue then they're mismanaged, it's Mayor Emanuel's fault, it's not my fault. But if, you know, schools don't open in Elgin and, you know, Oswego
and
Springfield, then it means that there's a larger issue.
I have to ask, you know, this is we hear this all the time. And Ray, you spent a large chunk of your career in Springfield.
Yeah.
But I mean, there has always been this idea that, you know, the one holding the bag for a school not opening on time, that's political suicide. I mean, and it's not going to be a finger pointer kind of thing, he said or she said. I mean, it usually falls at the feet of the governor. So it's
right.
Surprising that we even have flirting around this conflict.
Well, I think one of the strategies here by what we have here is a very unusual situation. Occasionally, a bill will pass. It'll be voted out, and then the head of the chamber will hold on to it for a while, not physically move it to the governor's office. And Senate President John Cullerton has done that. He's held on to this bill that Rahner can't wait to veto or put his amendatory veto on it. And the idea here is to put more pressure on Rahner to give in, to have to sign it, or to come to the table and come to some kind of agreement. Then Rahner, in an effort to try to beat back on that, he has blamed everybody and blamed Democrats for trying to kill education in Illinois,
He's even going tour in other downstate communities and saying, hey, I'll give you the money that I would a mandatory veto out for CPS. I'll give it to you.
Yeah.
So you
can
get more money to you. Yeah. So you should be mad at Democrats. Here's a question I have. And the one thing I will say about Governor Rahner, he gets criticized for moving goalposts and such. But in this case, he has been pretty clear from the get-go, even with the budget negotiation, that the pension payout to the CPS, Chicago Public School, he had offered it at one point. He had pulled it back. But he said it has to come with some sort of reform. This, in a way, feels very legislative in the way that they snuck it into a school formula bill that had nothing to do with school opening the door. And this is the way the Democrats are getting around that and putting a little political pressure on Rahner. But Rahner has stuck to his guns and say, I'm not giving you that 200 and whatever million dollars.
The problem with that, and I'm sure Forrest Claypool will be happy to have me make this argument for him because it's his argument, is that Chicago has 20% of Illinois' school children.
Yes, that's what the lawsuit was. Right.
And but Chicago gets 15% of state funding. And that's largely because of a quirk in the way that Chicago teachers' pensions are paid. Chicago is the only school district that has to write the check out themselves instead of the state paying for it. So there's a complicated system of grants and pass-throughs and everything that comes through Chicago. And this formula bill basically says we're going to treat Chicago like every other school district. And we are going to acknowledge that the state hasn't made some of the payments that we were legally obligated to make on behalf of Chicago's teachers. So we're going to move towards, like they say, like to say, pension parity,
right,
and sort of solve those inequalities. But you're right that Rahner sees his one sort of pressure point with the Democrats is the CPS pension monies, and he desperately wants to be able to run for reelection and say, I fixed Illinois' pension crisis.
Right. And without that leverage, he doesn't really, that's never going to get fixed.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how long they go. I mean, we'll see. Okay, we'll take a break here. We'll come back. We got overreported, we got underreported. We didn't even, and it's, and, you know, the big loser this week too, the president. I mean, we didn't even get into how many losses he had this week. There were a few. I mean, it's funny to think the beginning of this week was the Boy Scouts.
Yes, he. Yeah. The Boy Scouts had to apologize for what the president said at their jamboree.
That was this week. It doesn't even feel that way. All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about it. Ray Long, Heather Schroen in studio tonight. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Ray Long, investigative reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Heather Schroen, City Hall reporter for DNA Info. Both in studio tonight as we reload this week's news. Biggest stories we got through. Winners, losers. It's time for overreported and underreported. And we'll stick on overreported. And I think all of the stories kind of revolve around the satellite that is President Trump. Why don't we start? I mean, overreported, I guess, even though it's also a rabbit hole story and it's winners and losers and everything in between, yeah, is the feud that the new communications director, Scaramucci, and the chief of staff, who is no longer the chief of staff, who resigned today, Reince Priebus, went public in the weirdest way possible with an on-the-record, off-the-record conversation with a reporter, with vulgarities and really an introduction to a new communications director in the Trump administration that has all of America a little bit antsy.
Yeah. So I'll defer to Ray since he has covered politics longer than I have. But in any other administration, if you used that kind of language with a reporter and it was published, you would be looking for a new job. Straight up. But it seems clear, I think, from the reporting specifically from the New York Times today, that not only did President Trump not object to it, that he saw that as a battle between Scaramucci and Priebus, and that he sided with Scaramucci as being tough and strong and not weak.
I've never seen anything like that. And I mean, reading it, it probably was the number one New Yorker piece of all time, it was published in, just for everyone going, what? I got to read this again.
And the stuff they said about Steve Bannon, too, it was really over the top.
Think of that New Yorker fact checker who had to make that phone call.
I saw that going around. Mr. Bannon, I'd like to ask you something that Mr. Scaramucci said about you. this is the kind of communications that the president wants. Someone who's going, like you said, someone who's rough around, who's rough and tough, and isn't going to mince words, even if those words are ones that scarcely are heard in public.
Well, he likes to throw out the hard words, and now he's got a general in as the chief of staff, General John F. Kelly. So he's now going to be that rough and tough guy too.
But apparently, we have no acting Homeland Security Secretary, so.
I started off, I kind of was joking last week because it's only been a week since Scaramucci started, week and a couple days now. And I was somewhat impressed. I was like, now that is a little bit more of the cloth of what you expect a communication director to be. He can Teflon, he can bounce around, he can keep his temperament. Sean Spicer was almost not right for the job in the way that he got angry too quick. And we were like, But now you see a little bit of cracks in the foundation with an on-record, off-record. And the question is, Scaramucci says to the press after the fact, I shouldn't have trusted a reporter. All of that was off the record. And he's essentially caught in a lie. Here we go again.
Yes. I mean, you know, I wonder how much, you know, your average Joe knows about these rules, but, you know, Ray and I live them, and you as a person I'm interviewing can't unilaterally declare our conversation off the record. It has to be an agreement that we've reached beforehand, or at least, you know, immediately afterward. And it's a gentlewoman's agreement. And it's not something that you can just say, oh, well, that was off the record.
You can't go back after
especially
the fact,
when you're somebody who's the White House communications director. actor. You're supposed to know these rules. And, you know, I agree with you. I think it's overreported because it's essentially a contest between two men for the favor of their boss. I mean, that's essentially what it is. But these are the people being paid with our tax dollars, working the White House, who are responsible for running the federal government at a time when we are fighting wars in Afghanistan. We're fighting wars in, you know, all sorts of different places. And now apparently North Korea has an intercontinental ballistic missile that can hit Chicago. So there might be more important things going on. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, we just need an adult in the room here, or several adults in the room.
And that was supposed to be Priebus, right? He ran the RNC. He was a political professional. He, you know, had contacts on Capitol Hill, and he was... You know, he's only been there 6 months.
But I also say, Ray, I mean, it has only been 6 months, and it seems like the president loves turnover. That's the one thing I can take away from the early days here. But you know, there is something to be said that Rance Priebus was an appointment to Donald Trump who Trump didn't want. I mean, they were fighting and at each other's throat during the campaign.
Right. And same thing with Sean Spicer. I don't think that the president ever was really fond of Sean Spicer. But Spicer and Priebus were together in some ways, allies, if you will. And so, you know, you just get this whole ball of wax here. And Trump is now trying to clear the path and put in rough, tough guys.
Yeah, I don't think that the president ever forgave Priebus for recommending that he withdraw from the presidential election after the Access Hollywood quote-unquote locker room tape came out. I think he saw that as sort of an unforgivable weakness.
And you see that, I mean, we haven't even talked, again, that was this week. Jeff Sessions was this week.
Yes.
But the idea that that's the same concept, like when Jeff Sessions recused himself, he sees that as a point of weakness. I mean, there is something, there's consistency in the president's message that he wants the rough and tough guys and he wants no one to apologize.
And I would almost, you know, there was a lot of reporting on Jeff Sessions, but I would almost say that the actual news of that has been underreported, because here we have the nation's top law enforcement official essentially being publicly cyberbullied on Twitter by his boss, the president.
Flogged.
And exactly. And, you know, not only that, but for doing something that is clearly the law. If you're involved in an investigation, you have to recuse yourself. This is not something
that's one of the only things that makes sense. For
ethics are niceties sometimes. Yeah.
Interesting, I think, is that you saw some Republicans on Capitol Hill saying, if you go further, Mr. President, there will be ramifications, because, of course, the speculation is that, you know, the president wants Jeff Sessions to resign so that he can appoint a new attorney general who will fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel. And then we're off to the races.
And you know what? This has been a reload so far that has not even got into the Russian investigation. So I feel good that we're this far along. Heather Sharon, Ray Long. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We got underreported. We got these stories that took us down the rabbit hole. And what story is going to be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week? What will be remembered? That's the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Judith Owen is in studio. I'm so excited to have her here. The band is setting up behind Heather and Ray.
Yes.
This is probably the most exciting reload of the week's news with Judith and Leland Sklar as well, right behind you. That's pretty great.
Yeah. I do
notice legends in the studio.
A bigger crowd gathering
I don't
think is for us, Ray.
We'll try to focus. This is your chance to audition as a singer now.
My thwarted dreams.
Yeah, they're coming up at 9 o'clock, so they're in getting ready to sound check. We'll continue right now. 312-981-7200, the phone number if you'd like to get in on the reloading of this week's news. We're doing the biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported, which story took us down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from tonight. I have mine. I already know mine. I got two of them. I got two.
Yeah.
I got to save room for that. All right, let's go to underreported. 400th homicide. This is something that is startling.
It is.
This didn't get more news.
Yeah, it's so we're, you know, halfway through the year. Last
July
year,
28th, right?
Yeah, there were just about, you know, a little over 700 murders last year. We're on pace, you know, if not to meet that, to exceed that. Today, there was a four-year-old shot in the Austin neighborhood. His mother was killed right next to him. You know, we were at the city council. There was a measure introduced that would basically seek to hold parents responsible if their kids have guns.
They get caught with an illegal firearm,
because
right?
We've had a spate of robberies on the south side where it was, you know, 10, 12-year-old boys with weapons. And, you know, I think I've said this before on the show that, you know, my judge of how something breaks through is whether the mayor is forced to address it during the week, and he was not asked about the 400th murder. And I think we've just sort of...
What do you think it is? Are we desensitized in the
way? I think unfortunately. And we just see too many of the same things over and over and over. And we have all this craziness on the national level, too, that is just another part of that heavy blur that we're getting in the news cycle.
Well, you heard, we heard the president called, I think it was in Ohio at the rally where he said, "What's going on in Chicago?"
And again today.
Right. And he did it again today, and he called out Mayor Matt. He better get tough. The mayor better get tough. How does the mayor respond to this? I mean, are we done with this game of kind of responding when the
president... Well, the mayor would sure like it to be done because he hates it when I ask him to respond. But, you know, his response this week was that it's not about toughness, it's about smartness. And Mayor Emanuel has talked extensively that it's, you know, you need a holistic solution. You know, it's jobs, it's after school programs, it's and getting guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have guns. And it's not just about toughness. But, you know, I think that if... I have to say my breath was taken away living in Chicago and hearing the president say that he wanted police to get tough with suspects and hit their heads on the police cruisers as they were being put in. And, you know, I've written extensively about how the Department of Justice found that the Chicago Police Department repeatedly violated people's constitutional rights. So, you know, the president of the United States today got up in front of a crowd of officers, encouraged them to commit civil rights abuses, and a whole bunch of officers cheered.
But, you know, one of the things there is, and I think that's part of the Trump citizenry, that he wants to try to rile up the base, and he wants to try to get people to go, yeah, nothing's politically correct. Let's just go back to the good old days, which aren't really that good. And we've seen the really bad, bad things that have happened, and we're trying to get it under control. But when you get somebody out there who's trying to light the fire over and over again, you just can't quell the flame.
Yeah, and I mentioned that the Boy Scouts had to apologize. And of course, today, the Suffolk County Police Department, who hosted the president this afternoon, had to put out a statement. Our officers are not allowed to do that. That's just...
It's just a wake that is left of apology, wake, wherever the president goes. I mean, we've been talking for an hour and a half about this week's news. And all the stories that have happened. And we have yet to talk about transgender ban in the military. Oh, yeah. We have yet to talk about the Department of Justice, which I thought was very underreported, but the Department of Justice arguing against workplace
that
protections.
That the Civil Rights Act
civil
does
rights
not
for
apply
LGBTQ.
To gay people. Right.
I mean, these are – I talked about it on air yesterday and the day before. A head scratcher of why there seems to be a push to want to start these. It almost feels like the president is picking fights with communities when there isn't even – I mean, the Justice Department doesn't even have to get involved in that conversation, yet Jeff Sessions is putting it forward. I mean, they're being proactive in this case.
Yeah, these are tectonic plates in the whole political debate, and you're just moving them just at random. So then people are then ending up – thrown over into a whole bucket where they don't want to be and they don't deserve to be. So you have this, you once think that the nation and the social fabric and the moral higher ground is moving in one direction, and then you see it moving in another direction all of a sudden just because the president is out tweeting.
Okay, so moving on from that.
Super exciting, happy, fun times.
Yeah,
here.
Right. So, I mean, as we talk about underreported, it was interesting to me that the justice stuff didn't really get reported. And there's a lot going on. I mean, other thing from what happened today with the talking to the officers. But also here in Chicago, which I thought was a big story, and you just talked about it. The idea of the city council starting to think differently about how they approach gun violence. And that was with this ordinance, this proposed idea that they would give community service to parents if kids were caught with illegal firearms. This is something that I've never, I mean, think about the days of Mayor Daley and other places in the city council. This is not an area that they wade into, and it's surprising to me that they did, and I thought it was very underreported.
Well, and not only that, but they're not proposing jail time for parents. They're saying clearly something has gone wrong in your family structure and mm-hmm. that we have, as a city, need to intervene in some ways. It was, you know, community service is not always meant to be punitive, and the way the ordinance is at least written at this point, it's designed to sort of get these families, you know, that have been exposed to violence into some sort of supportive system, which I think you're right is a sea change from where we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, where I think people like Alderman Ed Burke, who proposed it, would be lock them up.
Absolutely. Heather Sharone, Ray Long in studio tonight, 312-981-7200. Let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do what stories took us down the rabbit hole and which stories will be remembered from this week 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from now. Stay with us. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Ray Long, Heather Sharone in studio as we are reloading this week's news. A couple of stories that took us down the rabbit hole, and then we'll talk about which stories will be remembered from this week. I think there's a lot. Usually that's a stretch, but I mean, runner-ups right now. The idea that North Korea has did another ballistic missile test that actually landed way too close to Japan, and the idea this afternoon that they say, I'm not sure who says, but they have a missile that could reach Chicago. That's a run. That's not even the one that I would pick, and that's a runner-up.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, things have gotten real.
Good. Yeah,
that may be the one that is remembered 500 years.
Yeah,
ago,
that's. I still think there are bigger stories than that, but that's a huge one. All right, let's talk about which stories took you down the rabbit hole. We'll start with you, Ray.
One of my own stories took me down the rabbit hole.
Those are the good ones, right?
That was the one where we dealt with a lobbyist for the teacher union, and he, a few years ago, jumped through a window that was drawn up through some legislation that allowed him to teach a day as a substitute teacher and then get into the teacher union pension and buy back 10 years' worth of union time. Not teaching time. He'd never been a teacher before, and he was able to buy into that, get some time into the teacher retirement system. And then when we wrote about it a few years ago, they changed the law and said, you can't go back and get that. Now, he said, hey, I should be able to go back and get that based on other laws. And he went to court, and guess what? He did not win. Surprisingly, a lot of people thought he was going to win. So,
well, I mean, this is the story.
This is a rabbit hole.
This is when you get pulled out into the we have corruption or people are taking advantage of pensions and why do we have the system and pension reform. It's when the stories like this come out.
And
where
unions.
And unions. Yeah. I mean, this is the one that you'll get people see.
Yeah,
this is the problem. But these are not the norm. These are needle in a haystack type stories.
Well, you hope. I mean, maybe if I dug a little more, there would be some
get
more
on
that
it,
I
right?
could find. Yeah, right.
What else you got to do, Ray? You're done
yeah,
with the water
right,
story.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So I'll be working on that.
All right. Heather, what do you got for a story that took you down the rabbit hole?
So today at that Staten Island event the president had, he again told the story of how he was in Chicago and a cop pulled him aside and said, if you let me, I could solve crime in a week. And we were never able to, and when I say we, I mean the Chicago media, were never able to figure out who this officer was. And the president talked a little bit more about it. Apparently he was a motorcycle cop. He said he didn't even need a week to solve Chicago's violence problem. He told the president said today, I could solve it in 2 days and I just need to get really tough. And of course we asked, and that he had gotten the officer's name and that he had passed it on to Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Now what's interesting is that Mayor Rahm Emanuel completely and flatly denies that the president ever gave him this motorcycle cop's name. And what's interesting is that no Chicago police officer motorcycle units were ever assigned to accompany the president through Chicago. So if this officer exists, and I feel like I'm living in a little bit of crazy town, that I am on the air of WGN openly questioning, you know, did the president make up this Chicago cop for his own purposes. But that's what the mayor of Chicago said today, that essentially to use Chicago violence, and we just talked about 400 people being killed, as some sort of wedge issue. And that is, I think, the ultimate rabbit hole story, because, of course, I can never know for sure that there isn't some police officer who rode a motorcycle in a, you know, a, some sort, exactly,
right, yeah,
who
happened,
said
right.
that I could have done it in 2 days, and that right. somehow, you know, the president has seized on this. And
yeah.
that.
And you've got this whole idea where Trump is out there talking about violating civil rights at the same time.
Yes.
Well, God help us, what that
motorcycle
effort
police.
Would
yeah,
be.
Right. Yeah, what is one week, being right. tough? And it's just, as a Chicagoan, it hurts my heart, because it's like we're somehow morally deficient in that we can't solve this problem on our own. Whereas, you know, people have given their lives over, and, you know, years of mm-hmm. hard, you know, mm-hmm. sweat and tears, and to solve this problem. And it just, you know, Mayor Emanuel was very frustrated with my questions today. I'll just put it that way.
My rabbit hole story, I didn't know anything about this story, and I have a couple, but the one we'll talk about, which was a big story we haven't talked about, was the plant that the manufacturing plant that was brought to, looks like it's coming to southeastern Wisconsin between Racine, Milwaukee, mm-hmm, and Chicago. Mm-hmm. Foxconn, which is a company that supplies parts for Apple for making iPhones. Huge number of jobs, 3,000 jobs. Donald Trump has a press conference suggesting, you know, Wisconsin, great place.
Scott Walker, great guy.
And what I thought was interesting was what sucked me down the rabbit hole was you started to see the editorial that the Tribune did that said, see, this is why we need more business-friendly government in the state of Illinois. This is what Bruce Rauner's talking about. We were never in running for any manufacturing plant in a blue state in the middle and with the city of Chicago in it. But yet we have these like hypotheticals that we like to pull out, that if Bruce Rauner, and I think it was, I forgot who did, but somebody called out, I think it was Dave Lundy, a friend of mine who's on Touche, he does Monday nights here. Where was our plan? Where was, did you have the Foxconn executives come to the state of Illinois? Did we miss that tour? Did you not invite the media? Where was the proposal from Governor Rauner in the state of Illinois? There wasn't one.
Secret plan to end
yeah,
the war.
Yeah. Yes. So I guess the point being that somehow politics plays in this, and then you go down the rabbit hole with what Foxconn, again, you know, they don't necessarily have the greatest track record when it comes to employees and their relationship with unions. And then the fact that how much money the state of Wisconsin put out in subsidies to get them, $3 billion.
Yeah. It's a million dollars per job that will pay $53,000 annually. And my frustration is, you know, I get a lot of emails, as you might imagine, and it's always about people taking from the government, you know, people on welfare, people on food stamps. And if that's not a government handout, I don't know what is.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that staggering amount of money that the state government had to pay, or the state of Wisconsin has to pay, just to get the jobs to this area.
Well, and we've written about, in fact, I dove into that issue here in Illinois just last year. We had this program that allowed the government basically to throw millions of dollars to companies based on the number of jobs they got, and they could cut special deals, et cetera. This program expired during this whole time that Foxconn was wooing Wisconsin. So where was Illinois in this? And if they were trying to do something, we didn't see it.
No, we didn't see it. And frankly, I was surprised. I know it's a very small set, but if you go to Facebook and you look at the post from the Chicago Tribune editorial board and you look at the Facebook comments, they're usually pretty conservative.
It's a conservative.
And it was surprising to see the comments almost in unison saying that this editorial is not right. Foxconn is not. It's not a great thing that this company came into Wisconsin. This is actually this is not a good deal for anybody. But jobs play a big role in that. But jobs are political capital, I guess. 312-981-7200. All right, let's wrap it up. This is what we've been waiting for, right? Which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from now? What was the story? There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, you could go with healthcare.
I'm going to go with healthcare.
You're going to go with healthcare, right?
I'm going to go with healthcare. Not only does Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, remain the law of the land, as I understand Senate procedures, if Republicans were to do something, they could no longer do it with 51 votes. They would have to meet that 60-vote filibuster margin, which I think makes it very unlikely that they would be able to do something that would not be bipartisan. But what's interesting is the number of Democratic lawmakers who did not dismiss out of hand Medicare for all or a single payer. Now, if you remember the Obamacare debate back in 2009, that was considered straight up socialism. And you could not find a Democratic lawmaker anywhere who would voice any kind of support for that. And I think that what we've seen in this debate has sort of shifted the ground, that tectonic plate that you were talking about, right? In that a large majority of Americans now believe that the government has an obligation to afford some form of affordable health care to people.
Yeah.
And I think when you agree on that, it changes sort of where the discussion goes.
That is the takeaway from this story, is that they were no longer debating whether or not there should be affordable public
options. And let's remember
options,
that what failed was, you know, quote unquote, skinny repeal. It was not a root and branch repeal of Obamacare. That did not come even anywhere close to getting 51 votes.
Right. We're on the 52nd year anniversary coming up on Sunday of Lyndon Johnson signing the Medicare thing, too. So,
yes.
Medicare.
That Medicare
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
All right, and what do you got, Ray?
Well, I'm going to talk to you about the one that we've briefly mentioned, and I hope it doesn't still be resonating 500 years from now. But, you know, if the North Koreans have got this missile that could, whether it reaches Chicago or anywhere in the United States, even if it's Alaska, let's say, you know, even in the wilderness and it's just affecting polar bears, this is going to be something that people are going to be talking about.
All right, I got two. You ready?
Yeah.
Fire.
Lay it on us.
You're the host.
Artificial intelligence story that came out of Facebook and Elon Musk that were arguing with each other. The idea that somewhere in Facebook labs, two computers were talking to each other in a language that they invented, that nobody else understood, and Facebook had to shut it down. That's scary.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff where you're like, yeah. And you know what they're saying? They're going, I don't like the humans. Do you like the humans?
I'm telling you.
I don't like the humans.
I don't like their tweets, frankly.
Battlestar Galactica is real.
That's a story we're going to remember in 500 years from this week. The other one, which I thought was really interesting, it can go either way, the editing of human embryos. Scientists were able to go in and mess with DNA and genetics of an embryo. That has consequences for health, for disease. It also has consequence for some strange stuff that's genetic engineering that we haven't even thought about. That's the story that I think we're going to be looking at this week in 500 years.
But we won't be able to think that far in 500 years because all of that will be edited out.
That would have been edited out. This week would have been edited out. Ray Long, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Heather Sharon, City Hall reporter at DNA Info. Can't thank you guys enough for coming in and reloading this week's news. Appreciate it.
All right.
Anytime.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on Sunday, it's Space and Evanston's 7 o'clock show. The Chicago area is in for a real treat. Singer-songwriter Judith Owen will be on stage along with legendary bass player Leland Sklar. Owen is an eclectic talent, one that's it's hard to put her into a category. The Welsh musician released her first album in North America back in 1996-ish and never looked back. She's toured the country with acts like Katie Lang and Brian Ferry, and she just released her 11th studio album called Somebody's Child. She's the co-founder of Twanky Records with her husband, Harry Shearer. Leland Sklar is a bass player who has played on over 2,000 records in his career. 2,600. I'm late. I got bad information. Right. Everyone from James Taylor to Phil Collins to pretty much anyone else who's ever recorded music. Both are in studio tonight before their big show at Space, like I said, in Evanston this Sunday at 7 o'clock, along with their other bandmates, Pedro Segunda, Helen Galay, and Rebecca Crenshaw, all in studio. And we're going to hear some music right now live. What are we going to hear, Jude?
You're going to hear the title track of my new album, which is called Somebody's Child, and it's really a song about a girl, a homeless girl that I saw in the winter in the snow on the streets of Manhattan.
All right, take it away.
Thank you.
There's a girl on the street in a trash bag dress. There's a baby in her belly and milk in her breast. And crossing the street, cause she's acting so wild. She used to be me, and she's somebody's child. Spare a little thought for down up, cause it's true. If the tables were turned, the deal was different. It might be you. Look at that man, he lives in his car. Cause a run of bad luck went and pushed him too far. A woman who lives in a box at the back. When she started out, did her dreams include that? So spare a little thought for down and out, cause it's true.
Fantastic. That's so great. Let the street. You guys like it?
Yeah.
There we go. Always good to get the Michigan Avenue crowd involved. They are. Judith Owen in studio tonight. Her band, of course, are going to be at Space in Evanston this Sunday night at 7 o'clock. Part of the band, of course, the legendary bass player Leland Sklar. Also, Pedro Segundo, who's on percussion. Helen Galay, who's on cello. And Rebecca Crenshaw, who's the violin player tonight. I mean, it's great to have you here. I know you come to Chicago a lot. I mean, what does it mean to you to have Chicago be part of the regular repertoire for you and your band?
Oh, I love Chicago. I really, you know, I mean, I'm here because of the fabulous Dan Filato, of course, who's just been a dear friend of Harry's and now of mine, and even drove me around on one of my earliest tours around America, which was a great thing. And my first experience of playing in Chicago was really with Richard Thompson, A Thousand Years of Popular Music. And so I became very much in love with this place and got to know it very, very well. And then once Harry and I started doing this show called Christmas Without Tears, originally to raise money for post-Katrina for New Orleans, which is where we actually live, to help the buy musical instruments and help the musicians there and get them healthcare. It became a regular thing at Space, and Space has really meant home to me.
That's a great place. It is
one of the most remarkable jewels of a venue because they care so much about musicians, about the way you're treated, about taking great care of you, about really, really nurturing them. You know, they have many venues now, I know, throughout Chicago, but Space means an awful lot to me. Well, we'll be going back again to do the Christmas show December 10th. But first, before I go back on the road to these wonderful people with to support Brian Ferry, I seem to be like traveling the world with him, which is so amazing. I get to do this just very, very few, headline shows. And that's why one of them, for me, had to be
To be here.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I said in the beginning, you kind of defy category. You're one of these singer-songwriters who... You can't necessarily say jazz, or you're not going to say pop music. No. But I mean, you do definitely. You could feel the influence. I mean, just in, just on that song alone, the amount of different styles and influences that you hear, is that intentional? I mean, the idea to sort of be everything.
Yeah, my I grew up in a household which was absolutely you know, knee deep in every kind of music you could possibly ever want to listen to. My father was a very successful opera singer at Covent Garden in London, so I grew up backstage at the opera. But he had a love of black music like I've never come across since in my entire life. I mean, New Orleans music, Chicago music, the R&B, the blues, gospel, Motown, everything, jazz, big jazz fan. My mother was a huge jazz fan, big band fan. So I was listening to Chopin and Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and Stevie Wonder and Aretha Franklin. And then I was also listening to desperately depressing Welsh folk music, you know, because that's who I Welsh people, you know, basically we live in the minor key. And Harry describes me quite beautifully as being the glass half broken, which I think is a perfect. There's not even any water in there. It's just the glass is broken.
I think about Chicago, and I mean, it's got such roots in blues and jazz and even soul music here. When you talk about being Welsh born or Welsh influenced, I mean, is that what really?
I'm Welsh. Welsh. You're looking at a true bird beaky face here. Isn't that right, lovely people on Michigan Avenue? I look so Welsh. It's true.
But I mean, is that the stock and trade of a Welsh musician is the sort of folk music? Is that the traditional music that comes out of that
our
area?
Thing, you know, you know, different parts of Britain. In Scotland, you're doing Scottish country dancing, and there'd be fiddles and the ceilidh and everything like that. And Irish, you'd be doing the crack, and as in not crack, but you know, the crack, and you'd be just going berserk. Welsh people are like Irish without the fun, I always say. And so we just like really depressing, depressing biblical music. And it's all about singing. It's all about the voice. So when you see or hear someone like Tom Jones, who absolutely is completely immersed in R&B and the blues and gospel, and then that's what you're hearing music and singing that's from the soul, and it's about the soul. And I think my music is pulled from every influence I've had in my life, including hearing this marvelous man to my left when I was a kid, and he was not much, you know, old. He was a kid himself. When I was a kid, singing along to James Taylor in the car, because my parents were such huge fans. How many of us have been singing along to James Taylor in the car? And literally, I was listening to Leland and Russ. You know, and then to be able to actually get together with him in particular, so the bass is so important to my music. It's such an extraordinary thing to be able to work with this man, with Ross Kunkel and Waddy Wachtel, and to do the last record, and then to do this, which I believe the first one, Ebb and Flow, was much more a love letter to the music of Laurel Canyon. That is such a you know, as a confessional singer songwriter, and but this one I think is so much more about the two places I live, America and Britain, and combining those sounds. And my style is all of that music, because to me it is one language.
Well, that's what you've lived.
It is my language. That's what I speak.
Judith Owen in studio, Leland Sklar as well, and I want to bring Leland in here. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation. Judith is going to be with Leland and the band at Space in Evanston coming up on Sunday, 7 o'clock start in Evanston at Space, which is a great place. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More music and conversation. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. I'm excited to have in studio with us Judith Owen and Leland Sklar and the band as well. It's just great playing on Sunday at Space in Evanston. I want to bring Leland in as well. Judith, the new record, Somebody's Child. We're going to hear two more songs this hour, which is great. I'm so excited to have you guys here, and I know the audience is as well on Michigan Avenue. I want to bring Leland in. Leland Sklar, legendary bass player. Thanks for being here. It's great to meet you.
I'm proud to be here. I love Chicago, and love being out with Judith and these crazy people were out here on the road with. So.
I would say that you'd probably, I mean, you talked about 2,600 different performances, albums, I mean, and also touring. Chicago has to have played a huge role in your musical career.
Yeah, we started coming here in 1970 with James Taylor, and this was like our annual summer stop. Every year we would come to Chicago, and I've always loved, I have a lot of friends here, and I love to come here and eat.
Sure. You
know, and the art and the parks and everything. It's a beautiful city. It's really a magical city. So,
you know, when I say that you've played on 2,600 records, you know, a lot of that is in session work.
Yeah.
When did you make that transition from being in James Taylor's band and being a bass player that was in bands to one that, you know, did so many different albums and became a professional session musician?
Well, I was really fortunate. I was kind of there at the golden age of when all this was really happening, coming out of the 60s. And we were kind of handed the baton from the Wrecking Crew people,
right,
even though I ended up working with a lot of those guys over the years. But when I met James Taylor, I was still in college. I was in science and art major in college in my fifth year, and met James, and we were offered one show to do at the Troubadour, and I'm still on that gig. But it was we were very fortunate because I think this is really due to Peter Asher, who was producing and managing James at the time. Was when we started recording with James, he insisted that our names appear on the LPs. So all of a sudden, when guys like Jackson Browne and all these singer-songwriters were being signed, because James went from obscurity one week to being on the cover of Time magazine the next week, everybody would look at the back of that album and they would see me and Russ Kunkel and Danny Korchmar,
right,
and they would say, well, if it worked for James, let's get those guys. And really, we had to kind of learn on the fly. I had never been in the studio. I had done a couple of demos with bands, but you know, suddenly we were on projects and really learning how to craft a sound. And we were doing, on an average, through the 70s, of 4 and 5 sessions a day, 6, 7 days a week.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was madness. Everybody was being signed, and it was just it was so vital and alive. And then through all that, like, I was in a band called The Section, which was the opening, which was the band for James Taylor and Jackson Browne. But we also went on the road with Mahavishnu Orchestra and were opening for them. And so I got to know Billy Cobham. So then he called me to do Spectrum. So suddenly I was in the fusion world. And, you know, it's one of these things that's just every time you turn around, there's a new thing. I spent like 12 years working out of Nashville. Even though I lived in L.A., I'd fly back every other week and did probably 600 albums out of Nashville.
One of the things I read about, I was reading an interview you did about the difference between, because you would think automatically that being a session musician, precision is the ultimate. But in your case, you talked about you never play the same part the same way twice. That it's much more about feel. And I'm interested and intrigued by that, especially in an environment where they're like, let's do it again.
Well, I really find myself living in the moment. I'm really not, I don't intellectualize my parts unless I absolutely have to. But I'm like a first take person. That's really where my juices flow. And after that, you find yourself by the third or fifth take kind of thinking, geez, my eyes are looking at that music and that's sending impulses down in my hand. And then you're going, oh crap, do we play the bridge yet? So I'm really spontaneous. You know, I try to be I try to rehearse my spontaneity as much as possible.
Right, sure.
But, well, Judith, but you know, even when we play live, I try never to play the same thing twice. Each moment requires a different response.
I mean, there's something to be, I mean, something great to hear that from you, because music at the end of the day is a creative endeavor.
Absolutely.
And there's something about the feel and emotion that goes into it.
Yes.
What makes you guys work in the way that you've chose to work with each other and continue to work with each other? What, talk about the collaboration between the two of you and why you continue to make music together.
I heard Judith the first time I was working with Harry, her husband, on this project that he did, The End of the Bushmen, about the end of the Bush administration. And we were playing at a place called Blues Alley up in Seattle. And he said, oh, my wife's going to sit in and do a couple of songs. And she sat down at the piano, and my jaw dropped. I really was not familiar with her work. I knew her as Harry's wife, but I really had no idea. And when she sat down at the piano, I just kind of took my breath away, and I felt an instant kinship with her, because her music was so much all of that singer-songwriter thing, even though that's gone on ever since James Taylor. I mean, every year I work on albums with singer-songwriters. But there was something that was just really special, and as soon as we started playing together, I felt a kinship with their
Judith. I mean, it was just because once we got to know each other, and obviously I already was a fan of Leland, and I'd been plotting and scheming for a couple of years how I was actually going to hit on him musically, and then this kind of this choice. Situation came my way where I actually, I was hoping, oh, I hope he likes me. And of course, it's perfection.
I like her.
And the reason it's perfection is because, as it turns out, when Leland started out and, cut his teeth with James Taylor, so to speak, James is a very heavy bass hand. He's playing the bass notes on the guitar, as well as everything else besides.
A
remarkable.
Really remarkable, underrated guitarist.
Incredible. Now, I am that solo singer-songwriter all these years who, when I write a song, it is complete.
It's
about that. It's like the colors that you then add to. It's like the dynamics you bring with other instruments, but it's like painting. You want to make the song greater. You want to bring everything out. You don't want to just cover it all because it's there. And the really remarkable thing about Leland is that he dances. It's like a duet, the two of us, and he is dancing with melodies around my left hand. So even though I'm already playing the root, and I always am, and there are times when he'll be taking it over because there's nothing that beats, obviously, the bass when it's really, that's what it's doing. But there's such a beauty. I think what's interesting about all the musicians here and all the musicians I ever work with, including my British string players as well, is that everyone comes from a classical background. Pedro is a classical and a jazz star, and that's with the crossover. Helen Gillet, Rebecca Crenshaw. We're talking about classical people, and Helen and Rebecca are from New Orleans. Well, actually, they actually live in New Orleans. I can't say it's from there because Helen actually does an awful lot right here and is a very, very truly superb cellist. Does a lot of work here in Chicago. And but we come from that same sensibility where we know that what we're doing is we are making truly a miniature orchestra.
I love
we
it.
Are like a tiny orchestra that are creating these little vignettes.
Well, let's do this. Let's get an update on tonight's news. And then we come back, we'll hear a little bit of that mini orchestra that is set up right in front of us. Judith Owen is in studio with us tonight, along with legendary bass player Leland Sklar and the band as well. They're going to be playing at Space in Evanston coming up on Sunday, 7 o'clock. What we'll do is we'll take a break, we'll get tonight's news, and then we'll come back and hear some live music here on 720 and WGN. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right. Very excited to have in studio tonight Judith Owen, singer-songwriter. She is going to be at Space in Evanston coming up on Sunday, 7 o'clock. Also along with legendary bass player Leland Sklar, who's in studio as well. And we're ready to hear some more music, live music, with the band, which also includes Pedro Segundo, who's on percussion, Helen Gillet, who's a cellist, and Rebecca Crenshaw on violin. All right, so let's get to a song. What are we going to hear now, Judith?
Well, you're gonna hear a song called "Send Me a Line," and it's really it's at my expense because I've got this new saying, which is "Life is what happens when you're so busy, too busy taking a selfie," and that is basically me. And I'm missing all the big stuff and the good stuff in life, but it really is about how none of us can cope even 20 seconds without a text being replied to, or, because then the world goes to hell in a handbasket. And here we are sort of looking over at Trump Tower, and I am led to believe at this point, who knew that this would mean so much singing it now and here tonight, but actually, we have our first tweeting. It's the president, the
Tweeter in chief,
reality TV and Twitter won over it. So hell, this goes out to the big guy. Why'd I go and write the things I had
to say. Second guess myself when it was too late, too late. And now my heart is out there sinking. Oh, body, won't you send me a line, send me a line. Oh, body, won't you send me a line, I'm dying here. You're waiting for your answer. I don't wanna close this screen at all, 'cause I could go and shop and get my clothes on. I am free to go wherever I want, but can't seem to make it out the front door. Oh,
there we go. Yes. Do we like it out there? Streets likes it. There we go.
Well, you know what? There is nothing worse in this world than sending out your heart and thoughts to the world and hearing nothing back.
Welcome to radio, right?
Welcome to radio, indeed. I tell you, it's so hard. That must be so hard.
Judith Owen in studio tonight with her band, including Leland Sklar in studio. Pedro Segundo, Helen Gillet, and Rebecca Crenshaw also in the band playing at Space. Coming up here in Evanston on Sunday night, 7 o'clock. It's great to watch you guys perform. And you mentioned the idea of the mini orchestra. And, you know, it doesn't sound like a normal orchestra of any form. And
no.
The way that, once again, I mean, at the beginning, asking about how you defy category and you use all the kind of music.
Yeah.
That song is a great example of the way that you use instruments and percussion that
yes.
isn't necessarily where you would usually find it.
Nope. I don't think anybody really on this particular gig plays in any straightforward manner or in a way that you would expect. I certainly don't as a player. I'm a bit of a beast on the piano and I'm singing, so I'm, you know, there I am powering along. But there's Leland moving all the way around me. You can hear it. It's such a beautiful thing. Pedro
just
is
trying to avoid you.
Okay, mate. You don't have to push it. We were getting on so well. I do love him. I do.
Nice.
They're big. That's enough. So I've got to bring the Brit out. Did you hear that? Did you hear the forcefulness
yeah,
of my
yeah.
voice?
No,
I love him. I love this man. I know. Well, I don't want you not turning up to the gig and going all... Anyway, Pedro Segundo, he's playing what I can only describe as what it is, a cajon that he's sitting on. And then there's this box in front of him that most people just go, what is that? It's the most bizarre wooden snare you've ever seen in your life. And then I've got my girls who are absolutely playing the most pompous baroque string sections, and together it makes complete and utter sense.
Leland, let me ask you about playing around the music. I mean, because
yeah.
I, you know, when I hear that, and there is, I mean, I by watching you play and listening to how the bass plays, you're right. I mean, it's not this sort of driving bass line that kind of it keeps everything structured. I mean, it's very eloquent the way that the bass in that song kind of dances around the music.
Well, it's like what Judith said earlier, like with James Taylor. I find myself a lot of times working with people
that have already defined the bottom end in what they're doing. And I kind of just had to figure out how to justify my phony baloney gig on what to do there. Because, you know, I mean, it's like you can ape them and just, you know, double what they're doing. But it always felt like I just had to find something that would kind of weave around that would lock that down, but also give other things. There are other projects where I'm really straight up bass playing on it too, but these kind of things, I really love this style of music.
I was gonna say, I mean, when you're going into work with somebody to record an album or to be in a session, are they looking for more of that? Is that sort of Leland style? I mean, are they looking to dance around?
You get that a lot. There's sometimes almost an expectation that's really a drag, because they sort of think you're going to save things. You're going to do something amazing. And you're just coming in and you're hearing it. It's pretty normal stuff. And you're going, I really don't know. I don't want to be walking all over it and stepping out too much. And sometimes you might walk away and they go, what's the big deal about him? You know, it's like, you don't know. You just don't know.
Wait, give me their addresses. But no, I'm going to go and sort them out. Like, I'm angry now.
No, but like last week I was working with Judith. We were in the studio doing new stuff, which is really amazing. And then the 2 days after that, I was doing a Japanese metal album. So, you know, you do whatever the call is, you go accommodate it. So you're kind of a chameleon.
Yeah. The thing about being as musical as Leland is I just saw him. He's been on the road with Phil Collins and in his comeback tour in Europe. And I went to see him in Bercy, and we were out there at the same time. And we go into this huge kind of arena in Bercy. And Leland is like holding it down like a mother. You know, it's just ridiculous. I feel so proud. But, you know, it's so incredible. What he does with me is an entirely different thing altogether. He is playing like a soloist. It's a very different
thing. What I noticed too is that in the collaboration of that song is a great example of just to couch this, but is that it does feel like there is an effort to be creative. There's creativity in it, and in your world, how much of that still exists? Because there was a time in the 70s and 80s and even with James Taylor that it was the band got together in the studio and you collaborated. Yeah. I would assume the way that the industry is kind of changed, it's become a little bit more like, can you come in and record this bass track?
I never quite thought that at this point in my career I would spend most of my time in somebody's bedroom. You know, that's kind of how you start. It's funny though. I mean, you get all these calls and everybody's got their Pro Tools rig at home, and I end up going over, and half the time I'm doing bass parts to just a click track or some drum machine that they say, we're going to replace that later. You're like, you know, like Kenny Aronoff's coming in next week and he's going to do drums I haven't got lyrics yet, but here's kind of a and you're trying to like really create parts.
Is that hard for you? Is it hard? I mean,
well, it's a drag because sometimes you hear it finished and you think, if I'd have known that that's what they were going to do, I wouldn't have done what I just did. But I don't have any reference point at that point in the project. But it's kind of gone full circle, and I'm doing so many more projects now where it's full bands in the studio.
Okay.
And a lot of stuff we're even going back and cutting analog, you know, doing tape, and the machine isn't no longer just the place to set the pizza box and hold the door open. They're actually turning them on and using them. So it's a different, you know, it's a different world, but it's the old world that's coming back in a different permutation.
Judith, how much, I'm curious, when you go in the studio, and you're going to work on this stuff, how much are, and because you said you don't like to intellectualize the music, but how much are you putting a game plan down when it comes to the song? I mean, saying, get together, all of you talk, this is what we want to do, this is what I'm thinking about. How much of it is that versus play this, play that?
No. Because I'm exactly, that's another reason why we all work so well together, is that I do the best take, the first one, maybe the second. And then I start overthinking it, and then I don't mean it anymore, and then I don't, and I'm confused. Then I have like incredible blanks, like, you know, like suddenly I can't even remember lines, notes, nothing. And it is that thing where I do actually like to go in. I mean, there's so much thinking about, you know, what you're going to do. And luckily I have wonderful people like Steve Lee, who's here today, who actually, you know, manages with me and gives me that, you know, that schedule and a plan to work to, because that's not my strength. My strength is going into a studio, as we did this last week. I've got the songs, I've written the songs, we go in, I play them through, I know what I'm hearing. Oh, a couple of them I'd already played with Pedro, so he got that rhythm and knew what we wanted. But when the three of us in particular, and this is something we learnt on the road in 2014 when I was arranging and writing the songs for Somebody's Child on the bus, And that's what we realized, is that the joy of being together and being field players, and it all coming from what is needed, what elevates the song, what gives it its meaning, as opposed to, I just want to show off my chops.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. It's like, and that's where I respect jazzers so much, and why I am jazz influenced, and when, you know, how could I not be? I'm so in love with people like Joni Mitchell. To me, it's that there's a freedom, because say we do three takes of a song in the studio, they will not be the same. They can't be. My singing isn't the same. My playing is not the same, and it shouldn't be, because it's about performance.
Well, and that's the jazz. And you've developed skills that equal the passion.
Yes.
And that's that. At the end of the day, that's the recipe for having a successful creative endeavor.
My desire as a kid was always to be the best musician I could be. And especially as a woman, you know, I couldn't bear the idea of somebody going, oh, can I help you find that chord? Or, you know, it's just like, to me, I was just, I found it too, I take great pride and have a very healthy ego when it comes to this stuff. You know, I really do pride myself in being a strong musician. It is the love of my life, and it is for all of us. And so I don't take it lightly. It means the world to me. It's not that I do it because it's the thing I love to do. That's true as well. But I do it because I can't not do it.
Absolutely.
And I've never met a passionate musician who doesn't feel that way.
What else are you going to do then? That's right.
Because I'm awful without it. You know, I'm the darkest, Welshest person in the world without it. And you don't even want to be around with me. It's awful.
It's just horrible.
It's terrible. Yeah.
Judith Owen in studio, singer-songwriter. Also, Leland Sklar, the legendary bass player. They and their band will be at Space in Evanston on Sunday night, 7 o'clock. All right, let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll get one more song live studio.
Lovely.
Judith Owen, stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with us tonight. Judith Owen, she's singer-songwriter who is going to be at Space in Evanston coming up at 7 o'clock on Sunday night. Also along with legendary bass player Leland Sklar, who's in studio tonight as well. And the band, Pedro Segundo, who's a percussionist, Helen Gillet, who's a cellist, Rebecca Crenshaw, a violinist, and they are all here right now, the mini orchestra.
The mini orchestra. I really hope people are going to, especially the folk that come out for the Christmas show, I hope they'll come down, because they're always sort of like, when are you coming back? But not in that accent, obviously. So I'm just hoping that they will actually come down, because, you know, come on down, peeps.
Yes,
it's going to be
please.
A great
night. I'm going to try to make it. So that's how it goes. Okay. So what are we going to hear here?
Well, I figured that because we're just about to go out again and open for Brian Ferry, this is the right song to finish with, because back in, I think it was 2015, we were touring in Britain with him opening, and I remember, you know, the funny thing about being a touring musician is that you get these great highs, but when you're opening, you get this short, compressed, incredible, you know, amount of time that you're like shot from a, you know, from a cannon, and then you've got to find somewhere to put your adrenaline afterwards, because you're on such a high, and you end up going back to, like, you know, the Radisson Blu or the Hilton or something, and you're sitting in your bedroom thinking, well, this is crap, you know, and I don't like to hang out too much with the band. They're too rude. And so I found myself thinking, this is the saddest thing. I missed at the time. I was weird. And as I said, and I was missing my husband and my dog and my family, my dog and my dog and my dog. And it occurred to me that every time I heard Brian sing this song, it made me think not of romance, but of the fact that without the people you love in your life to share these amazing, precious, rare moments doesn't really mean as much. Truly, there is nothing more than this.
Here we go.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing fallen leaves in the night. Who can say where they're blowing
was fine for a while. There was no way of knowing, like those dreams in the night. Who can say where we're going? More than
so good. Yes. So good. Singer-songwriter Judith Owen will be at Space in Evanston coming up on Sunday night, along with legendary bass player Leland Sklar, also the band Pedro Segunda, Helen Gillet, Rebecca Crenshaw. You guys, I can't thank you enough for coming in.
Thank you so much for squeezing us. And also,
I
of course, to the guy himself, Dan Philosopher, for putting us together.
Well, I appreciate it. And again, at Space in Evanston on Sunday night, 7 o'clock. A pleasure to meet you, and thanks for coming through. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, that was fun. That could have been a 3-hour convo. Just talking about the bass around the music. I could do that all night. And, of course, Japanese metal. We didn't even get into that. We didn't even get into that part. It's a download here. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up, very excited to have Lori Raider Day and Kristen Lepianka in studio. They are two mystery writers. We're going to talk about their new books together. They're doing a joint autographed sign and reading conversation in Forest Park coming up tomorrow night. So we're going to talk with them tonight together, which is awesome. It's rare that you get a chance to talk to two great writers at the same time, especially about one genre. So that'll be fun. And we've had a lot of thriller, crime fiction, mystery writers on the show recently. You know, obviously anyone from like Sarah Paretsky and the we've had her on the show, but Mary Kubica was on, right? Marcus Sakey last week. So I feel like this is an area that we have continued to have conversations about. It's awesome to talk more, and it's kind of the perfect time as Duffy and I were doing promos not too long ago, and we're talking about like the idea of the summer readings, like beach reading, as they say. And that's always fun and good when you talk about that in May. But then you get to July and you're like, we just ran out. You're done, right? I'm done with that book, Hui. What am I going to do now? Well, we've got two options for you coming up tonight here on The Download. All right. Yeah, I really enjoyed that conversation. That was fun. They're so good. And it was so fun. You know, I realized, Pete, rarely do we do music, live music on Friday nights. right? I mean, we do Studio 435 Monday nights here on Download. But we rarely do Friday nights, right? And we did Friday night, and how about it? The crowd on Michigan Avenue, because there's so many more people and tourists and action that's happening on Michigan Avenue. There was at one point they were listening to Judith. There were 7,500 people.
Yeah,
and it makes me go. It makes you go. Oh, maybe we're onto something. Maybe we switch it from a Monday night, rock it to a Friday. But then you got to compete with actual bands doing work, right?
I think we were fortunate enough they had a break in their touring schedule. Yeah. I think they're going to they're somewhere else tomorrow before they come back to space.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's awesome. And my favorite part of the entire the behind the music is that they had a huge tour bus, right? And the tour bus, if you're going to load music into the Trib Tower for this show, you have to do it from Lower Wacker Drive. You have to do it from Lower Michigan and pop up. Right, that's usually where they do it. But their tour bus was too tall to go down on Lower Michigan.
Yeah.
So they effectively, they double parked it on Michigan.
Yeah, the lights are blinking
over
there.
The lights have been blinking for 2 hours. Like, I hope it starts. But more importantly, I love that you can just go ahead and double park a tour bus on Michigan Avenue. Like, what luck.
Yeah.
Like, I give them a lot of kudos. I give their team a lot of kudos. Because truly, down here, if you see a huge tour bus like that, you just expect it to be here. You know, but the idea that you just double park it right over by the Wrigley building.
Yeah.
Just keep it there.
Just sitting there. I can see it from the window.
Nobody said anything. Like, nobody went over there and said, it's a little parked a little too close to the Lincoln statue on Michigan Avenue. No, they're just like, nah, it's so good. I love it. Now Judith can tell people she came to Chicago and she's double parked on Michigan Avenue for the gig. Well, she'll take it, right?
Well, we got to have, when they come in for their Christmas show, she and Harry come in for their Christmas show, we got to have them back.
Absolutely. That'd be so fun. Yeah. Why not, right? All right, coming up, Lori Raider Day and Kristen Lepianka in studio. We're going to talk about their two novels that are out this summer. Stay with us. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow night, two mystery authors are joining forces to celebrate the publications of both of their new novels. Both Kristen Lepianka and Chicagoans Lori Raider Day will be reading and signing their respective books at Centuries and Sluice Bookstore, Forest Park. Kristen Lepianka's new book is called The Last Place You Look. This is Kristen's debut novel, and it's getting great reviews. She also is the founding editor of Betty Fedora, the semi-annual journal, which publishes feminist crime fiction. And Chicagoan Lori Raider Day is out with her third mystery. This one is called The Day I Died, which is also getting great reviews. Lori is the president of the Midwest chapter of the Mystery Writers of America. We could do a whole hour on that. That's awesome.
You sure could. We have 450 members.
There you go. Lori, Kristen, it's a pleasure to have you both in the Download tonight. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So let's talk about first off, before we get to your books, and I want to talk about the work, what was the idea of both of you getting together to do this together? I mean, because usually you will do events where it's just one of you signing, you're the main event, but having two mystery, almost having a double bill, that's somewhat unique.
I just like to do events with other writers. I think it's more fun. There's more energy. It's less work. Justin, if I can be honest. But also you support each other. You're sort of team up for the long haul. It's not just one event. It's sort of supporting each other. The mystery community is very supportive. And you also bring in each other's fans. So I'm going to bring in some fans for Kristen, who is not local. And then someday I'll do an event in Columbus.
There you go. Kristen, for you, I mean, this is your debut tour in the way that you're touring around. Talk about it. Talk about coming to Chicago and the idea of actually doing press off of your debut novel.
Well, Lori is a total pro at this, so I really appreciate her looping me into the fun. But this has been a real whirlwind of an experience with the book coming out. I've been kind of on a world tour. I was in London, then Boston, New York, and now here. And it's just been such an amazing opportunity to talk about the book and talk about myself, which is a little uncomfortable, but I'm trying to get better at it, and just meet people and talk about mysteries, and it's been amazing.
Do you have to? I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, because if you go bookstore to bookstore and you're taught and you do interviews and things like that, is that usually where you find the story going to talk more personal about yourself and who you are and things that you may not have had to talk about before?
Well, I think anytime someone asks about the book, they're also kind of asking about you and why you wrote it that way. So they're one and the same, really.
Lori, okay, so mystery, you said about the mystery community is supportive. And I really want to get into this, and I'm glad to have you here. It's, I've seen the Mystery Writers of America. Like,
oh, good.
I mean, I've seen it around. And I'm always like, oh, I'm intrigued by that. But having you in tonight, you know, when you talk about the mystery community, what is that? Does that mean mystery writers? I mean, talk about what the mystery community consists of.
Sure. It's actually more than the mystery writers, but it is the mystery writers. Chicago is a great town for mystery writers. We have a lot of them here. And they're all wonderful. But we also include readers in that term, the mystery community. We go to a lot of conferences, or at least I've gone to a lot of conferences. I know Kristen's been to a few. She's just getting started. That are reader conferences. So we go as writers to talk about our books, but we're there to talk to readers. Also reviewers, mm-hmm. Media professionals like yourself, anyone who is just really into the mystery reading.
I mean, what is it? I mean, I guess Chicago plays a big role because there are a lot of mystery writers here, and we've had a long-standing history of doing that. But, I mean, is that something that you don't see in other parts of the country? I mean, is it able for to break it down almost like musicians, where, like, there is a certain type of musician that's in Chicago other than that? I mean, do mystery writers sort of, are they born here?
Oh, they're definitely born here. They're born here, and they move here, and they make their lives here. Chicago's a great town for mystery writers. There's a ton of them, but there are mystery writers all over the world, obviously. There are, I think, 10 or 11 chapters mm-hmm. of Mystery Writers of America. So when I say there are 450 members of the Midwest chapter, the one I'm the president of, and Kristen is a member, I think I strong-armed her into that, actually, but she listened to me. But there are, you know, that many members ish in 10 or 11 other chapters. So there are lots of mystery writers, but also people who want to become a mystery writer and just aren't yet, would like to work on it.
What is it? I mean, let me ask you, Kristen, this is your debut album. This is your debut novel.
Great.
I know, I got music on the brain. I apologize. But you know, I mean, why choose mystery? What is it about mystery and being a mystery writer that appeals to you?
Well, all my life I loved reading them, and I think mysteries are fun to read and to write because you can kind of enjoy them on two levels. There's the puzzle of figuring out who did it, and some readers just read it for that. I actually had someone send me an email the other day that said something like, I usually stop reading books as soon as I find out who did it, but I read yours all the way to the end. And so thank you, I guess. But so you don't have to necessarily care about the characters. You can just read it for the puzzle, or you can sort of get really into these characters and their lives. And as a writer, it's sort of an opportunity to like slide some clever human truths in there and some lessons and wrap it all up in the package of a good story.
I mean, really, when you think about mystery writing, I mean, it's popular because it is intriguing and there's obviously a connection that the audience has. But what do you think that is? Why do you think the audience, there's such a strong audience for people who want mysteries over love stories, over actions?
Well,
other
don't
places.
Denigrate the love stories.
Right. I don't want to get the love story.
I don't
story.
Want to get the letters, yeah. Right, Justin.
But what do you think it is about mysteries as humans, as we read this, that keeps bringing us back to this genre?
Well, I think mysteries, there's a lot to them, and there are a lot of different reasons why people like them. A lot of it is vicarious living another life that you don't get to live in real life, but you get to read about it, and you get to live that life, one of danger or just being very smart and very, you know, getting into situations that you wouldn't normally get into those situations in real life, but you get to when you read the mystery novels.
And there's something to be said about the idea of even living vicariously through, or even, you know, a lot of people wanting to know more about you and through your work. Mm-hmm. This idea that a lot of mysteries, and this plays out in several, the idea is of people doing things that's out of their comfort zone. The main characters, others around, that's part of the of almost in the tool chest, like of what the main character, in your case, the mom, who, you know, not necessarily sure that this is what your life was going to be, but you turn into almost to this investigator, detective, things like that.
Yeah, she's pretty reluctant as far as investigators go.
Yeah.
But she's definitely found herself in a place in her life that she did not expect. And she, I'm going to lose my complete train of thought here.
No, that's
Justin,
okay.
Give me another prompt.
No, okay. But I mean, let me ask you, Kristen, just the idea of, as when you're coming up with your main character, And in both of your cases, these are characters that are distinct in the way that they're not the normal kind of protag or the main character, meaning that you have, in your case, Lori, it's a mother who's is the kind of hero here. In your case, the main character is bisexual. There's twists even in sort of the idea of who the main character is. And you don't necessarily always see that in mystery. There's, for whatever reason, mystery, I guess, like a lot of society, kind of plays on the white male as the main character. But when you're talking about the idea of changing that up and twisting that and moving and kind of playing with the idea of the stereotypical main character of a mystery, you're actually that there's something great in being able to do that.
Yeah, it's really exciting to explore different ways of telling this type of story, because historically these, especially with mystery series, the characters have been white male detectives, and anytime women are in the story, it's kind of a smaller part. It's the femme fatale or the damsel in distress. Women characters often don't have a lot of agency in mystery novels, and there's plenty of examples of like sort of kick-ass detectives that are female, but as far as bisexual characters go, it's pretty much non-existent. There are a couple here and there, but usually bisexual characters are written that way to be sort of shorthand for someone being dishonest, or it's sort of used to say, oh, this character is confused, or this person's a slut, and it's very offensive, really. And so I wanted to write someone who is bisexual, and it's just a part of her life. It's just a natural thing going on. It's not a plot point. It's not the center of the story. It's just the way she is, because that's the way people are in the world.
Well, traditionally, when you talk about mysteries, do you have to push back on that stereotype? Because it almost feels like stereotype is called tradition. In the way that, I mean, that those are, like you said, the femme fatale, or if somebody is bisexual, they have something to hide, or they're sneaky in the characters. Do you have to kind of almost, you know, you have to be aware and you have to push back on that?
I mean, I think so. I think people, readers, don't even realize how prevalent those types of stereotypes are. And so doing something a little bit different is a conscious choice. It's not just something that, you know, naturally occurs. So people are kind of wondering why, and I've gotten some comments of like, what does it matter what sexuality the main character is? And it's like, well, of course it matters, because it's not a represented identity. Mm-hmm. And so we really have to go out of our way to showcase it.
Is there too much, for Lori, from your vantage point, stereotypical identity issues in mysteries?
I think there can be. I think what you're kind of alluding to is this like tough guy, right, you know, lone wolf guy who like seeks justice for the sake of justice. And we see so many of those stories, and there's nothing wrong with those stories. Readers love those stories. That's why there are so many of them.
Right.
But there are tropes. And I think Kristen and I are like in this way that we want to write beyond the tropes. We want to write stories that are more than that.
Yes, for sure.
Lori Rader Day and Kristen Lepianka are in studio tonight. They're both going to be together on, I guess, on stage in conversations, signings at Centuries and Sluice Bookstore in Forest Park tomorrow night here in Chicago. Kristen Lepianka's book is The Last Place You Look. Lori Rader Day's book is The Day I Died. Both of them together tomorrow in Forest Park. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break so we can get an update on tonight's news, and we'll continue the conversation. I want to get to, because I've had a couple of mystery writers on, and there's a lot that goes into the what's in the toolbox. And I want to get your thought about the twist and the other things that I've learned about from mystery writing, crime fiction, things of that nature. Like I said, Kristen Lepianka and Lori Rader Day in studio tonight. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Lori Rader Day and Kristen Lepianka. They're both mystery writers that are going to be together tomorrow in conversation and in signing at Centuries and Sluice Bookstore in Forest Park. The only mystery, mystery
the theme? Only mystery-specific bookstore in the Chicagoland area.
There you go. I didn't even know that. Centuries and Sluice in Forest Park tomorrow night, Saturday night. Lori's book is called The Day I Died. Kristen's book is called The Last Place You Look. You know, did you both, I mean, Lori, you're on your third book.
I am.
When you set out to to be a writer? Was mystery at the front, or was it more like you moved into that genre?
You know, I had to be told I was a mystery writer. So I did an MFA program, a Master of Fine Arts program here in Chicago at Roosevelt University. Shout out to the Lakers. And I started writing a short story, and it got pretty long. One of my teachers said, this is not a short story, this is a novel. And then I went to this retreat, and I was put in the mystery group right around the same time. So I was like, okay, first of all, it's a novel. And now it's suddenly a mystery novel. Indiana mystery writer Terrence Faraday was the guy who was like, kid, you got a crime in your first 15 pages here. Are you going to solve it? Because if you solve it, you might be writing a mystery. So saying.
Is that really the simplistic way to look at what a mystery is, if it's a crime in the first 15 pages?
If the story of the novel is the story of the crime being solved, then that's a mystery.
I got it. Okay.
It's possible to have a novel with a crime in it that you either don't solve, or it's just solved, but it's not the story.
Right, right. You know what I mean? Okay, so, you know, we were talking in the break just about, you know, I've had some writers on, and we've talked a lot about both mystery and crime fiction and things of that nature. And I guess they're all in the same. Are they
Nobody
close?
Knows. It's all marketing.
It's a mystery. No
it's
one.
It's all marketing. So where does I'm going to ask this question before we get into the twist. But crime fiction is the same as mystery, is the same as thriller. I mean, are they all the same genre? I'm a victim of the marketing. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
I think that. In a mystery or crime fiction, main character is solving the crime. In a thriller, the main character is in danger. And sometimes those two things overlap.
Sure.
But sometimes they don't. And but then you also have suspense, and there's just so many different...
Suspense is a whole different
types
genre.
Of labels you can apply to all this. No. But they all kind of live in the same... You would, like, put them on the same shelf.
Just all about trying to find, like, helping readers find the books that they'll like, right? It's just all about trying to find group books together so that the readers will be happy with what they pick up.
It's interesting because when I think of mystery, there's something about it in my head that I go, oh, this is a genre that goes all the way back to Sherlock Holmes, and, mm-hmm. and I think that it's a very traditional. When I think of crime fiction or thriller, I think of the stuff that might be paperback in an airport Hudson's, you know what I mean? Like
I was in a paperback in the airport at Hudson's.
But my point being that like there's a difference. Like it's almost the idea that it's tradition versus consumerism, and I mean, and maybe that's why they call them different things. Like thriller gets you the more the kind of the fast reads and the stuff that might be more palatable to mainstream. I don't know.
Well, in mystery, you usually have is a body. To be blunt, a dead body within the first, let's call it 50 pages. And then the story is to solve what happened to that person, who killed that person and why, right? In a thriller, as Krista said, the person's in danger. You're sort of, there may not have been a murder yet, but there might be many murders. There might be a bomb about to go off. There might be a big, you know, something big is going to happen. There's like a ticking clock that the reader is going along with the character. So I think it's a pacing thing in some ways.
And of course the twist, and this is what I want to talk about. The idea of Mary Kubica was in here not too long ago, and we talked to Marcus Seiki as well. Both, you know, talking about how important the twist is in any book. The idea of this close to the end, blow the reader's mind kind of moment that has gone from almost an art form, and people who do that well do this genre well, to something that's expected that the reader almost judges the whole entire piece on. Where do you guys stand on the idea of the twist and how important it is to a mystery?
I don't think you necessarily have to have a twist that you call the twist. I think the way a mystery is built is there are several twists placed in strategic locations in the book to keep the reader turning the pages. And the thing is, a bad twist can definitely ruin the book, and a good twist can make it, but I don't think it is required to make it a good book. And you can get into a thing where there's too many twists and it gets confusing and you're swerving all over the place, and that's no good either. So I think it's really about making sure that it's the right twist for the story, not just kind of inserting them in there.
And the right story for the story. I mean, we're more interested in telling a good story and keeping people turning the pages than any one specific tool in the toolbox. I think the twist, So the ending is really important to us as writers, because the writer, the reader becomes, they turn from a reader into a reviewer right at the end.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so even if they've been enjoying it all along, if the ending is bad,
they get pulled out.
They get really pulled out, yeah. And they get very unhappy. And you don't want that. I mean, our job is to satisfy the reader. That's the best part of being a writer.
When you're both writing mysteries, I mean, and it's such a skill that I feel like it's way past me. I have no concept of how to actually get my brain to work that out. Do you storyboard it? I mean, is it the idea that you have this, you have to go through it and get the actual crime and whodunit and all that stuff down before you actually go in and get descriptive with how the story plays out?
I used to not plan ahead at all. I would just sort of wing it, and then it turned out that made for some very like mushy middle parts of what I was writing. So I am a bit more rigid about it now. I'll do an outline, but it's not super detailed. It's just kind of a guideline to keep those plot points in place. And I definitely, like, as I'm writing, different ideas will come to me. So it's not necessarily I knew exactly what clues were going to be dropped and where. It's more like I knew generally where the story was going. And as I continue to think about it, it sort of just occurs to me naturally where the clues should go.
I'm at the very end of the, what we call the pantsing end of the spectrum. So there's plotting at one end and then pantsing at the other, pantsing being riding by the seat of your pants. I would like to nudge toward the middle a little bit, like Kristen seems to have done. My process is very haphazard. I usually know one or two things and I just start writing. And then when I learn new things, I write some more.
Well, you know, that's interesting because we just had Judith Owen in here and famous bass player Leland Sklar, and they talked about their process when they go into a studio, that they don't map it out, that they understand what they're going to do as musicians, and they go in and they try to use their passion that almost matches their skill set. They're skilled in what they do, and they know how to work music, and they almost take that opportunity to try to catch that moment, catch that feel in that moment. So it's not unlike
a jam a little bit, yeah.
But I mean, in the same way that you're like, that's the idea. I have an idea, and I'm gonna take the skill. I know how to write. I've developed a skill. I'm gonna go for it.
Well, it doesn't get any easier, though. I'm afraid to say this in front of Kristen. It doesn't get any easier,
no.
Justin. It's each book is a new book. It's a new story to tell. And so you have to sort of learn how to do it all over again. I think what I have learned is that my process, as messy as it is, does pay off eventually if I just stick with it, if I just keep writing. I have part of my process I've come to understand is the dark night of the soul, where I think that I am not going to finish this book, and this book is not going to come together. I'm just going to have to throw it all away and start over.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually 3 weeks long, but I still call it the dark night of soul. But I've done it for all three of the published books and for the one that comes out next spring already. So it's just part of my process.
There is something to be said about, you know, when you're writing in this and there is no immediate feedback, even if you are getting, if you have people that you can send stuff to, but you're not at the point yet where people are consuming it. There has to be some emotional roller coaster in there. And the idea of like just saying, am I going in the right direction? Is this right? Is this wrong? That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely, it can be scary because like you're in control of what you're doing and like no one is there to tell you that's the wrong way, go the other way. And so you can write 40,000 words in the wrong direction before you realize, oh, right. And then you sort of have to just put all that in the trash. But it's also exciting that no one else is in charge. That means the story can be the exact story that you've always wanted to read and never have.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. All right. So I'll ask about the written word. You just mentioned about, you know, going 40,000 words in the wrong direction. I'll ask you both as writers, how precious are you with the written word? Meaning, will you go 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 pages and be able to kill your babies and say, this isn't going the right direction. I'm going to trash it. I'm going to get rid of these words that I put down on the paper. I mean, where's the line when it comes to the words that come out of your mind and what you do with them?
I don't think that I'm that protective, but maybe I am, and I just don't want to admit it. I have definitely thrown away huge chunks of writing. I wouldn't say 10,000 words. I haven't done anything that large, I don't think. But I think you have to sort of you know, write the story you want to write, hope that it's getting close, get some help. You were saying, you know, you could write 40,000 words and then throw it in the trash can, but you don't have to write that way. You could actually get some help, and someone can tell you how to make those 40,000 words better.
I can tell you from recent experience that they were the wrong direction and they needed to go in the trash.
So you're okay with letting them go?
Yeah, I'm ruthless. Mm-hmm. Just if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Get it out of here. The last place you look is the fifth manuscript that I have completed, but it's the first one to be published. And during the revision process, I basically ripped out the middle two-thirds of it and rewrote it.
Wow.
So that sort of trained me to just go for it, and there's no point. And when I say trash, I just mean like another file on my computer, and maybe someday
right,
I'll
it's not as dramatic.
Salvage it.
You're not setting fires, right? Right. Well, yeah. I mean, for it's such an interesting world right now when it comes to this kind of work, because I've had writers in on the show who have talked about how thrillers, mysteries, crime fiction become sort of all the rage in Hollywood. You know, you've seen it with movies like Gone Girl and others that have sort of become this a new genre that's always been there, but now a genre that's been updated. And instead of looking for screenwriters to write screenplays and in that art form, they're looking towards fiction. They're looking towards novels, and you see more and more authors getting optioned and that kind of. Do you think about that as when you talk about being a career as a writer, the idea that your work is not just a work that at one point was just for the reader who was maybe reading it in their, you know, on their beach in the summer, but now it's got a life that could live outside of the pages?
I don't think about it in terms of like Hollywood, because it's such a small, tiny, tiny fraction of things that ever even get optioned that actually get made. Mm-hmm. And so just to think about that, I think, is setting yourself up for heartbreak. But it is very interesting that this thing that I wrote is now out there in the world and people are reading it and having opinions about it. And I don't even know them. And that's crazy to me, right?
What are they doing with our books?
Like, how did they get these books?
How did they get them?
Okay, the new one, The Day I Died, is actually, I started it as a short story 10 years ago. So it is especially odd that people know that story now. Right. Just, I'm like, how do you know about her?
Right.
Yeah.
10 years.
So, yeah, I mean, you obviously have to, you know, you temper expectations, but is there a certain point when it's not necessarily, and I try to remove in the question the idea of fame. Or any sort of like, you know, mm-hmm. Hollywood, we got a jacuzzi now. But I'm talking about like as careers as writers. I mean, do you get to a certain point where that just is part of the career as a writer? If I'm a musician, there are options for me to go be session musicians or write my own music or join a band. But as a mystery writer, and she's writing in any of the genres we've mentioned tonight, it seems like there's more options for what your work can do, especially getting paid for that work mm-hmm. to be done. Than there ever has been before.
When I went to my first mystery conference in St. Louis, this is probably 2011, the one thing I noticed, and I had just found out I was a mystery writer. I didn't know anything. I didn't know anybody. There were 1,800 people in the building, and I knew one guy. I looked around, and what I noticed was there were a million different ways to be a mystery writer. Hmm. There were so many ways to get published. There were so many ways to promote yourself. There were so many kinds of mystery books. There is no one path. Kristen and I are on a very similar path,
yes.
But probably just based on the kind of writing that we do and the kind of stories we like to tell.
Sure.
But there's no one way to be a mystery writer. There are a lot of great and interesting ways. I would love to be optioned. I'm sure Kristen would love to be optioned as
sure,
well.
Yeah.
If any Hollywood producers are out there, want to talk to us, you know.
This is a Tastemaker program right here.
Call Justin. He knows how to find us.
They're listening right now. No, but I mean... I guess for you guys as we get close to wrapping up here, you know, you both, as you said, you're in this this same path, right? This idea that you're both going in the same direction. What does that mean? You know, for you as writers, and I think of the world of any artist, there's going to be a lot of collaboration. There's going to be a lot of encouragement. There's also a lot of competition. But what does it mean to be in the same genre and the same path? Especially, you know, with Chris and you having your debut novel and you being three novels in. I mean, the idea of what's it mean to be on the same path?
I, we just both want to have a career writing books that we want to read.
Right.
And I don't think that we have any delusion that we're ever going to be Stephen King. There are very few Stephen Kings out there, but there's room to be the kind of writer that we like to be, we would like to be. And it's more than just writing the books and publishing the books. And I talk about the mystery community being so supportive. Part of it is just getting to know this tribe of people who like the same things that you do and who are great to hang out with. We're doing an event tomorrow because we like each other.
It's true.
We just, you know, you get to hang out with your friends and write books on the side.
That's good.
And it's nice to be understood by, like, other people who've Googled various things regarding murder.
Kristen LaBianca and Lori Rader Day in studio. Kristen's book, her debut novel, is getting great reviews. The Last Place You Look is the name of it. Also, Lori Rader Day, also getting great reviews, The Day I Died. Lori's also the president of the Midwest chapter of the Mystery Writers of America. Lori, Kristen, thanks so much for coming in tonight. Appreciate it. And good luck with the event tomorrow night at Centuries and Sluice Bookstore in Forest Park.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Fun show tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next here. We'll be back on Monday. Coming up Monday, how fun is this, man? SNL cast member Kyle Mooney. The new movie Brigsby Bear coming up next week.
Awesome.
Also next week is Lollapalooza week.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to give away our secrets, but we pretty much ask every single band that comes to Lollapalooza to come on the show. It's like we have about 650 requests out to hope to get two, right? There's a lot of great bands that are coming through.
We also put in a request for Red Hot Chili Peppers every year around this time.
Even if they're playing or not. Just because. Yeah. I'll bet you we could do that. We should do like some sort of ongoing campaign to try and get Flea to come on the show, but he would.
Yeah, why not?
Why wouldn't they? But yeah, Lollapalooza next week. It's amazing to think that we're already to the beginning of August. But yeah, Kyle Mooney coming up on Monday. We'll talk about Brigsby Bear and that movie. I really like that movie. It's coming out next week, I think, and I saw the screener for it. I think it's going to be a hit. Again, with the preface that I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm no Rich Roper. I'm not, you know, like those guys are skilled. They understand it. When I go see any movie, I'm like, oh, that was good. But I really liked it. I really liked it.
Yeah,
I like Kyle Mooney, right?
Yeah, he's great.
He's so great. And
weird and
that weird,
goofy.
That weird, goofy, warm sort of like kind of emotional character he plays on SNL is what he does in Brigsby Bear, and he does it really well. It's nice to see that spread out that way. So you could see that working. So, all right, Patty Vasquez coming up here and here on 720 WGN. But like I said, very fun that next week Kyle Mooney with some other stuff. I can't, you know, off the top of my head, I don't have it in front of me, but we have a lot of great stuff coming up.
We had the Capitalist Pig.
Oh, yeah, Jonathan Hannig, right. I've known Jonathan for years. You worked with him at LS.
Yeah.
He's got a new book about that really is a photo book about the trading pits. And he's been a longtime contributor to a lot of economic financial news, right? So we'll talk with him. That'll be fun. And many more. There's a lot of great stuff coming up. I'm excited.